And he basically, I spoke to him several times and he said, no, don't come here because you're not good enough. So on the 2nd of January, I flew to New York, finally made my way to Gainesville. And I called from the payphone to Ian's house and said, hey, Ian. And he said, yeah, you klink naby. There was always a delay back then. I said, this is a great line that we have. Anyway, so he says, you sound like, I said, well, I am. I'm at the Gainesville airport. I can't repeat the words he said then, but in a nice way, he told me, don't you effing go anywhere. And I'm like, where am I going to go? I'm the only standing on the sidewalk here. So 20 minutes later, this SUV comes racing and then he gets out. We've never seen each other. We've only spoken. And he gets out, doesn't say, he says, Father, F, don't you do ye? What mark ye? And I said, I'm coming to play for you. I'm reporting for duty.
Listening to Mike DeJong this morning, which we have on the podcast, and we had lunch before we came on, and I thought to myself at some stage, we have to stop this conversation now.
Yes.
Because we want to repeat some of it that was said before this. And Mike, you've got such an incredible story. And I'll tell you, Eric van Rooyen, when he sat here the other day, I was a bit starstruck with him. I said to Arthur, I admitted to him last night. And Eric says, you know, he never gets it. He doesn't understand. And he says, but now when people come up to him, it's like, Eric, you're an inspiration for me, you know, your journey. This is exactly, and you never know, and how many people you've obviously inspired right around the world. And there's a next generation coming as well that wants to be in the game that you are, all-rounder, it seems to be in sport and in business. And I would like to know more about that because I sometimes find myself all over the place a little bit as well. I don't know if you have ADHD. My generation never got those pills that we referred to earlier. You know, our generation, they were just like, we're not quite sure what's wrong with this guy, but he'll make it.
No Red Bull for you.
No Red Bull. That was the only advice we got when we were at our age.
Yes.
Our remedy was you go see the principal.
Yeah, and get six shots.
Yeah, that sorted you out very
exactly.
Quickly.
Mike, I can't tell you how many shots I took for not being able to sit still in the classroom. You know, my mom's a teacher for disabled kids, and they, you know, go on sort of medication quite a bit to stabilize it. And once my mother, who's like, you have to, the new modern technology, I go and see a doctor. He puts me on, I don't know what it is, but one day, I phoned him, but I said, bro, I'm like a zombie. I've learned to adapt now. You know, I've learned this is the way I live. And even last night at 8 o'clock, we did OG until about 6. 8 o'clock last night, my wife's like, how can you still have this energy?
Yeah. Just you don't want to lose the personality. I mean, keep the energy.
Mike, welcome to us, and thank you very much for taking the time to sit with
thanks
me
very much.
Arthur.
It's a privilege.
Oh, thank you so much. And Mike, I'm just going to ask you to, this was probably the last time you'll hear from me on the show because you're far more interesting to listen to. So please tell us a little bit about yourself, Mike. And if you don't mind, tell us a little bit about the journey and how it ended up at golf. And at some stage, we want to touch on your business side as well, if you don't mind, because you've got this brilliant business and sports career. And I'd like to know more, all of us.
Yeah, thanks very much. Great being here. Heard a lot about your show, so looking forward to seeing where this goes. I guess I was just very privileged to have a very fun and interesting life, and it's you know, I guess partially the way my life is structured, and you know, I come from a Christian background, and you kind of believe that your path is set for you, and I'm just very blessed. So people sometimes say these are great stories. It's nice, you know. I didn't plan it that way. It's just the path that my life took, and I was the lucky guy to sit front left and just experience all of it firsthand. So it was fantastic. I was a normal guy through school, loved sport, did everything I could get my hands on. And by the time I got to matric, which was at Uffies here in Pretoria, I was doing 7 different sports. And funnily enough, tennis was the one that I took up when I was 16 in Standard 9. And that I took up just to join a mate who was not athletic at all, and he came running to me one break and said, great news, they're going to have another tennis team, and that's for us hacks down there. And I said, well, I'll come play with you. So I actually went to, you know, support him, went and bought a tennis racket. That was the year before I moved to Pretoria at Ron for Lee in Port Elizabeth at a multi-store of sorts there, and just we went and played league matches. We were terrible. But I loved it. It was nice. All the other sports I was doing national level and interprovincial colours and all of that kind of stuff. And funnily enough, tennis became my career, the one that I was the worst at and decided to do for fun.
Yeah.
So I won many SA titles, track and field and swimming and biathlon, many of them, and had a lot of fun doing that. And sports was, in our house, was life, you know. So I never thought about, do you want to do sports or not? It's just what we did, and we did it because it was fun. You know, it was a thing to do, and I love competing. And I think a lot of lessons in life are learned around sport, you know, which later in life, we can't all be professional sportsmen our whole life. So some of those principles then carry into life, which I think are valuable. So anyway, I went through school doing that and then went to the University of Pretoria and I studied a BCom, planning to be a CA.
You're still fighting that tennis pool.
Yeah, basically. I was number 6 at the University of Pretoria when I started there. And in my third year, I finally got to the top of the pile and SAUs and all the nice stuff that happens at university. And then at the end of that year, tennis really accelerated for me. I started getting a few results, nothing amazing, but I started seeing some improvement, and the idea popped up as in golf and is in tennis. College is an option in the States, and then I can really play ball, you know. And I was looking for the accelerator because I was so far behind the 10,000 hours of Oaks that have been playing tennis since they've been 5 years old that I thought college could be a great place. So I did my BCom and then told my dad that I'm not going to do the bar exam to become a chartered accountant. I'm going to play tennis.
Happy.
And he said, "Is jy seker?" And I said, "I am. I think I want to do this." And he said, "Well, then we support you 100%. So it was quite an easy transition. Went off to the University of Florida. My father happened to do his master's degree at the University of Florida in 1970. And I was born in 1970 in February. And 10 days old, my mom flew me over there. And the first 2 years I lived in Gainesville, Florida. So that part I wanted to go do in Gainesville because my dad was there. And I wanted to go see what he experienced. So that was a bit of a going back to the roots kind of thing. And a guy by the name of Ian, or as they call him, Ian, Duvenage, Divanage van Kuruman, was the head coach at the University
of
Florida.
Theron.
So he went to the University of Miami many years before that, did his college, played some professional, then stayed in the States coach, eventually made his way back as assistant coach and finally got the head coach position at the University of Florida, where I then popped up. And I spoke to him several times and he said, "No, don't come here because you're not good enough. I like you and it's a South African, we spoke Afrikaans." He says, "But I'll help you get into some other smaller university." In December, sitting in Plettenberg Bay's beach, my dad said, "So where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to the University of Florida." And he says, "But you don't." I said, "That's where I'm going." So on the 2nd of January, I flew to New York, finally made my way to Gainesville. And on a Sunday afternoon, I called from the payphone to Ian's house and said, "Hey, Ian." And he said, "Jy klink naby." There was always a delay back then. I said, "This is a great line that we have.
And you could hear that. You couldn't hear
that. There was a huge delay. You'd like talk over each other. Absolutely. Like a stutter. You know? Anyway, so he says, "You sound like..." I said, "Well, I am. I'm at the Gainesville airport." I can't repeat the words he said then, but in a nice way, he told me, "Don't you effing go anywhere." And I'm like, "Where am I going to go? I'm the only standing on the sidewalk here, and it's about 15 miles outside of Gainesville, the airport. Where am I going to go?" So 20 minutes later, this SUV comes racing, and then he gets out. We've never seen each other. We've only spoken. And he gets out, doesn't say, he says, "Vader, F, dink jy, doen jy? Wat maak jy hier?" And I said, "I'm coming to play for you. I'm reporting for duty." And he says, "I don't have a scholarship for you." I said, "I don't want a scholarship. I want an opportunity. That's what I want." And he was freaking out. He says, "I don't have a dormitory for you." Yeah, I don't know. I said, "I don't know. I've organized my own accommodation. Just take me to this address." So he took me off, dropped me there on a Sunday afternoon, who was actually my father's professor way back when he was 1970. I stayed with him for 5-6 days while finding an apartment and setting up a life. Joined the first few practices and did what we had to do. And then they have a walk-on system, which you'll know about. That's when you get your scholarship, guys. And then walk-ons are invited from everywhere to just for a day or two come play. They're afraid they miss a talent under their noses.
Okay.
So then they invite all the locals to come and play. And then they might say, "You're a walk-on. We're going to let you join the team." And he said, "Come to that walk-on." So I did that, played, and he gave me a spot on the team, in the big team, not the starting lineup. But at least you get kitted out, you get rackets, you get all your shoes and all your equipment, and I started training with him. And when the first match rolled around, I played at number 5 in the singles, and I played number 2 doubles, and then off went the season without a scholarship. And some poor guy with a scholarship sat on the bench. And the next year I got a scholarship, and at the end of that season I turned professional, which back then didn't mean much. We were quite terrible. But we played professional events, made money, travelled the world, saw everything we wanted to see, and it was kind of, you know, play for pay and find your way around. And then at some stage, Amanda Kutso, who was a good friend of mine, gave me a call and said her coach at the time was coaching Mark Philippoussis and herself, which meant back then the tours were running quite separate. These days they got many combined events, as golf is now starting to bring the tours together. So he would spend 3 weeks with her and then 3 weeks with Philippoussis, and the majors, of course, were combined. So she asked whether I could join her for those 3 weeks when he's with Philippoussis, because we used to train Decembers in Plettenberg Bay and then go to Australia. And she loved the way she felt after we did a couple of training sessions. So I went over as a training partner and just a companion and whatever, and we did the 3 weeks. And then Gavin Hopper would call in the evenings watching the match on TV and say, you guys need to work on this, do these drills, and he'd kind of run the show. And at the end of the 3 weeks, she asked the terrible question, which is, so what do you think of what my coach is doing with me? And I said, don't go there. I mean, you understand that in golf. Mm. You see some oak and you badly want to say something, but you don't mess with a coach, player relationship, you know. So I said, no, that's not happening. And my opinion was he was absolutely going in the wrong direction. She was a small lady. The game was moving, well, small. She was 5 foot nothing. And the game was moving towards power hitting. So Mary Pierce, yeah. Venus, Serena, Lindsay Davenport, Monica Seles was already there. Steffi was there. The game was just getting bigger, bigger, bigger. And today you got the likes of Sabalenka, and they just hit the living daylights out of it. And Amanda, so he wanted her to start flattening the ball. She played with a lot of topspin. And I disagreed with that because I thought her foot speed was her biggest attribute.
Yeah.
So the harder she hits it, the quickly they put it in the corner, and there's no power she can generate that'll move them off the baseline.
Okay.
Nothing she can scare them with. So all she's doing, she's losing time on her defensive game, which was her biggest attribute. Where if she hits the ball with a lot of air and
Almost like Nadal,
but Nadal takes it to the level of revolutions, yes, which is super special. So, and it's the same. They don't want to move off the baseline. So if you can hit it with a lot of spin and get it close to the baseline, they hit it on the half volley. And that brings in the factor of making mistakes. Mm. At the same time, while the ball's in the air, she covers an extra 2 meters to the neutral position to get in. If she hits it flat, Lindsay Davenport turn, she's scrambling. She's raking it back instead of playing constructive defense. And I refused to answer her question, of course. We were sitting in the Intercontinental in Berlin. That's where we were at the time, when she was having a steak. She'd lost in the semifinals. And I said, no, I'm not answering that. And she said, I'm asking you as a friend, not as a... Yeah. I said, no, that's cheating. You know, that's really now cheating. Because it's a fellow coach out there. It's a professional. You don't get involved.
Yeah.
But anyway, then I said, well, this is my opinion, and you know, that's it. And anyway, we left it. And I played a lot of money tennis, similar to soccer. You signed with a European club they allowed one foreigner, and you try and help them win leagues and whatever. So about, I don't know, 6-8 weeks later, she called me again and said, I'm going into Europe on the indoor season, another 3 weeks. Would you like to come and join me again? And I said, yeah, cool. I need to play Sundays for my club, but otherwise I'm there. So if you're in the final, you're on your own. So lose before the final and I'll be there for you. Kind of attitude. Anyway, we did another 3 weeks. It went well. She started asking for one or two things and we'd, you know, talk about it. But I wasn't coaching her. I was just giving my philosophy of the way she should play the game. Anyway, so one night lying in bed here in South Africa, I had that Nokia 3210. I don't know, had an aerial of about a meter long, and I don't know, that big brick. And
I this wish thing, I kept mine.
Yeah, this thing rang at 3 a.m. and it was Amanda. And she was all teary and emotional, and she just lost in Key Biscayne in Miami, which was a massive tournament, and she just fired her coach. And she says, I want you to coach me. You coaching me. You coming. I said, whoa, slow down. You know, I don't have a visa for the States. I don't see. My dad's calling you in the morning. This is what's happening. Anyway, I found a way to get a 10-year visa in 2 hours. Got on a plane, flew over. Her first tournament was in Hilton Head, which is a massive tournament, and that's her hometown. And the top 20 all had to play that. And she ended up, so Venus was there, Serena, Steffi, they were all there, and she won the tournament, her biggest win the first week that we were together. Yeah. Anyway, I spent 2 years with Amanda. From there, Mary Pierce, as I said to you at lunch, called me and said, well, I'm a lot better than Amanda. So if you can do that for her, then you can do that for me. It was quite cocky.
I like it straightforward.
Quite cocky at the time.
Straight to the point.
So Mary Pierce was next, and after that, Ai Sugiyama, and then I had the great honor of working with probably the greatest, well, Margaret Court has been in the news this week saying that she's not getting enough respect for her 64 major titles that she won overall, but Martina Navratilova, I managed to work with her for the final 6 years of her career. It was that final comeback that she had at 42, 43, and she played up until 2006 when she won the US Open mixed at the age of 49 and 11 months. It was a month before her 50th. She won her 59th major, which is singles, doubles, and mixed all piled up. And she retired, I retired. And that was the final retirement for me. I had two small retirements before that, and then a few people spoke me out of it. And then started doing some business with some mates. We had a management company for many years, helping athletes, you know, doing events, lots of events. And then got into a company called ASG. We started that in a brand. Started with Rudy Project as a brand and built that up for 2 years. And then added about 18, 19 other brands. Eventually, we had 20 brands in our stable, all in cycling, and then the eyewear across all sports. So Pinarello, CD, you know, all the most expensive cycling brands, all Italian. And eventually, we owned some of those brands in Italy. We had an Italian office there for ASG in Bassano, where we had Chicon and one or two of the other, F-Tech and some of the big brands that now still dominate Tour de France and all the others. And in 2016, we sold to a venture capitalist that came in and bought out the business. And then did not much before COVID knocked us upside down, and then built a few other small businesses that I have now. So I've got four or five active smaller businesses now. Play a lot of golf, no more tennis. And enjoy life as much as we can.
Why retire?
It's probably, I guess when you retire, you do it because you look forward to something else in life. Okay. And that was not the reason, because I loved what I was doing. I was one of the few men's coaches who for a very long period of time survived on the women's tour. Because with all due respect, men in a very short time say, you need to stop your nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, and that doesn't work.
And managing women saying the right and wrong things are tough.
100%.
I mean, emotional aspect.
Very emotional. It's you know, women, there are many things I've learned through the years in sports specific, but, you know, a simple example, you know, a lady would come to the table in the morning and you'd say, what's up with your hair? And she'll burst out in tears. Yes. You've messed up the whole day. Where a guy comes in, he goes, well, stuff you, man. I'll wear my hair the way I want. If you don't like it, comb it, you know, whatever.
In fact, it's a natural chirp for us.
It is. Yeah. Now, even if you did a good job,
exactly.
You'll get a chirp.
Even if you did a good job, you'll still chirp him.
So it was a skill that I had working with the ladies. As I told my wife when I finally settled down, I said, I think out of all men on this planet, I probably know women by far the best.
Yeah.
And I don't know them at all. Those are the two things I've learned. So it's an ongoing learning curve.
Well, Mike, if you say that, we've got no chance.
It's not that we don't. It's just it's a continuous learning curve. Yeah. And I'm sure they say the same. It's the old Venus Mars story. But I had a skill. I could work with them. I could deal with emotions. I could, you know, you had to win with what you had on the day, you know. And I had that skill. I was good at it. I loved what I did. But when you travel for 20 years and you can't have a braai with your mates, you can't yell at the ref like I've quite heavily done in the last few weeks with a box, I can't go to my own church. We say, also, hey, dumb, so you want to hang with your own people. Yeah. I want to play golf on a Wednesday at Silver Lakes, like I'm not doing today, by the way.
Yeah.
That's a massive sacrifice. No meat day today.
Yes, like Mike, so thank you so
that's
much.
It's probably the first time this year.
Thank you so much in advance.
So, as golfers, you know what sacrifice that is.
We'll give you a meat voucher on the way out.
Luckily, he's got connections in some butchery.
I know he's got the odd butchery connections. So, I don't know what my family's going to eat the rest of the week, but. So the big drive behind that was having a more normal. I wanted to have kids. I wanted to get married and settle down, which 20 years on the tour was never fair to any partner to try and have them fall into my life. A, give up what you're doing, join me on the tour and hope it works out. If it doesn't, then you left hanging in the, well, you golfers know all of that when you have a girlfriend and they want to be there, but they've got to have their lives because what if it doesn't work out or you don't make it? Or there's always these questions to be asked. So I just felt it was unfair at that time to have too many serious long-term relationships. So at a certain point I said, well, and I want to marry a South African girl. There was no doubt. I mean, wonderful women all over the world, as you all know, but I wanted one of our own, you know, so... the devil you know rather than the one you don't, you know?
100%.
So anyway, that was it. And then I felt that was a good time with Martina calling it. And I've had some very interesting offers over time and one or two very difficult to say no to. But I'm very happy where I am now and what I'm doing. I make more money there in a month than I make here in a year. Yeah, so if you ask me what would I want to do tomorrow, I'd like to coach a great ladies tennis player on the WTA tour, but then the tour needs to be around Pretoria for most of the year. So if you're playing, it's something different because you're doing it for yourself. When you coach, you're living someone else's life, which is great because you're part of that whole journey. Strategy and journey. And the things I saw in my life, I would never experience. I had tea with Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin.
Yeah,
I went into all kinds of pyramids where people never get to and saw some funny mummies down there who were some famous oak a million years ago waiting for, you know, to wake up and do his thing. So there's a lot of experiences that I'd never had without the journey that I took. But at some point I said, I want to get married. I'd like to have, you know, a family of my own and live my culture, my life. And let's see what we do later. You know, you can always go back. It's a phone call to IMG and say, if there's a youngster coming along, I'd be interested, you know, that kind of thing. But, for now, life is good. So I'm not looking. I'd love to do it, but I'm not looking
actively
to leave.
Pursuing.
No.
If you know, before I'd like to go into some of the stuff you mentioned now. But if I have to ask one of your students, why do you think you were so in demand? Why specifically did a lot of people insist on working with you? What makes you so different or special? Is it technically, or is it mentally?
I have absolutely no idea. No, I do. I'm joking. I do. I probably didn't know it at the time.
Yeah.
But as you get older and you see how things work, I think I now know what my skills were, although I maybe didn't. I just had them. Yeah. It's not something that I tried to acquire.
It didn't stand out
at
the time.
I didn't need a great short game and go work on it. I was just born with hands, you know, if it's a golf and that. Some guys are just great putters, you know, and other people struggle with putting their whole life.
Yeah.
So two things. One, I think I have reasonably good people skills. And I touched on this whole thing with men and women. So when you have men in the women's game that are successful, they're normally very successful because the women respond to the man because I can still beat her on the tennis court. So there's a respect from a playing point of view straight away, where when it comes to the intellectual, it doesn't matter who gives you the information, but just because that physical respect is there in terms of the tennis skill, I can serve bigger than her, I can. They tend to want to go because you're a better tennis player. Although I'm not in the men's game, but I'm better than the best female out there. So there's a physical respect, and secondly, I knew how to work with women. I was patient enough and didn't get fired for a stupid comment. After 10, when the men's coaches got together, that's where we needed to say, you won't believe what I had to deal with today. And the next I could say, I'll see you and I'll raise you. And we go, holy cow. But when you, and it's about 7 beers later and then you sleep and tomorrow morning you're ready for anything. Bring it on, baby. I'll suck it up. And I go, holy cow, what is she thinking? Yeah, that's okay. That's okay. Here we go. And you have to work, get the information to the hard drive so that they can fire, you know. So I had a skill to do that. But what I found out later that probably my strength, and this is in all coaching, not just women, that was women specific, was that I was an absolute crap tennis player. So I started at 16, which was very late. So then I started to play against guys who were top 100 in the world.
At a much more experienced level, inexperienced.
And
level.
Technically way advanced. They had hours on me. So I didn't have the shot production that they had. So I had to use my mind to figure out a strategy that I could neutralize them. Golf is different. I'm not playing you. I'm playing the course and you. Yeah. This is match play. I'm playing the guy on the other side of the net. So if he doesn't like a slice cross court, then that's what he's going to get all day and he's never, ever going to see anything else. If his best return is the back end, he's going to be served belly button all day long. He's going to be handcuffed. So I had to figure out how could I level the playing field. And in that way, it developed my brain to a level where if I was playing a guy in the top 100, that he was a lot better tennis player, but I was way ahead of him in a mental, analytical strategy, knowing my game, know how to play. He's never going to see. So my B game against his A game would lose every day. But he's never going to see his A game. I'm going to get him into a B game, and now we're in a battle, and I'm mentally tough. He's getting frustrated. I'm playing at a level where I'm just getting more confident and fired up, and he's getting ticked off because he can't play where he wants to play.
You're disrupting.
And I break him down. So, you know, many people ask me, what was your greatest win ever? You know, who's the greatest player? I said, well, there's a few guys I beat that were well-known names, but that's not the point. My proudest thing is that on many, many great tennis players, CVs, I list as their worst loss. But it's funny how I'm across so many of them listed as their worst loss because they figure you should beat this guy. But then after a while, you see this guy's not that bad. He just has a skill that's not just hitting the ball. So that was my proudest, is that every oak that I see now that were great tennis players will drink a beer and they go, I still can't believe I lost you in Stuttgart. And I go, yeah, well, you and many other oaks. So I didn't beat anyone. Just a lot of guys lost to me, which was great. So that was my skill, which actually prepared me unknowingly for my coaching career. Because now you give me Mary Pierce, who's the greatest striker of a tennis ball by a woman to this day that I've ever seen. And I said to her day one in Cleveland, when we sat outside the gate on a bench before going onto the court, I said, you're going to win everything you play as long as you hit it the way you hit it, but you think the way I think. So I need to teach you to think, and then you execute what you have. I mean, she had unbelievable skills of hitting a tennis ball. And she went to the very first tournament, and she beat Barbara Powell's first round. It was 21 in the world. Then she beat Conchita Martinez. It was 7 in the world. Then she beat some chick called Venus Williams in the quarterfinals, and then some other chick called Martina Hingis, who was number 1 in the world in the semis. And she went on.
Stop, you know, just to listing them. Random names.
Yeah, just random. They were okay. The point is, we worked for 10 days, and then after 10 days of her understanding the patterns and what she had to do, and she went out there and she beat 5 of the girls in the top 7 in the world. You know, so that was my skill, but it was developed unknowingly as a terrible tennis player trying to just compete. And I was getting frustrated. And eventually I was actually developing a skill that probably the man upstairs was getting me ready for where I was going and the job I had to do. And I think that's what distinguished me, because I could help them think. Yes, I could help them with a forehand. And when things go south, technically I could assist them. I was a good coach. But my strength was in teaching them to see the picture they're supposed to see, make the right decision on a certain time and use. I've got 3 weapons. It's not very difficult. It's ABC. They've got 27, and they often pull the wrong arrow out of the quiver. So being talented, it's not always easy because you have too many options. Yeah. I only have 2 options. It's slice or there, and I just hit it down the line. I never go cross court, I'm killed. So I just stuck to my game plan. They see thing, and there's 27 options, and they don't know. So I train them into a pattern that if this happens, the player is there. That's the length of the ball. That is the only shot available to you. I don't care if you see the other 7, but I can make it. I don't care if you can make it. That is the shot that will win you the point 9.5 out of 10 times. And to train the brain into limited skill, huge thinking, instead of huge skill, limited thinking. And when you put my mind on their skill, it became a potent
combination.
Will it be a fair point for me to say that you and Rossi have similar skill sets?
I don't know. I never sat on the stadium roof with cards and told them to serve wide or down the line or whatever Rossi does. But I don't think I would dare compare myself to Rassie, because I think he's an absolute rugby brain, which I think is ahead of his time, and it was proven in the 18 months prior to Japan. But I would go as far as saying probably similar. And I've never met Rassie, and if I ever do, I think it, I would really enjoy 2 hours of just talking sports and thinking, understanding the way the mind works, because I believe that there would be a lot of similarities in how we approach sport and how we see it. So I don't think I'd compare myself with him, but I think it's someone that I could find quite parallel to my thinking in sports. And I'd like to – my biggest frustration is watching rugby, and it's not whether they make passes or miss kicks. It's to understand what the strategy is from the coaching point of view. Because if you then execute it and it doesn't work, or the final pass is dropped, but to know what they are thinking – you know, box kick, box kick, box kick, and we get all crazy. But depends what the game plan behind it is. And when you talk to them and they tell you why they do it, all of a sudden you look at it differently.
Differently.
Rather than just swearing at poor Fuff and his big left foot.
Or Vali LaRue.
Or Nick White.
Or Nick White.
Let's not go there. It's been a good day so far. Yeah. I don't want to go down there. Yeah. But Mike, it's so important. And I just want to quickly touch there on. So, we speak about this all the time, and I can't speak from an Arthur perspective or from a you perspective that's been in that particular, you know, from a professional level perspective. But I've seen a lot of golf swings. I'm used to golf data. So I take out black and white. The skill set for a lot of golfers are there. The one thing that is the difference is always the mind.
And 100%.
It's not just from a – I absolutely love consuming knowledge. And if you go back – on books in the 1930s, that was already a part that they worked on from a sports perspective. If you look at pilots in the 70s when they introduced mental programs, because they knew that everybody will be able to know the joystick and where to go this and press this button, that you can learn a robot. But there was a certain angle of mental capacity which they had to sort of read the room, read the flight, read that part. They never could just train people. There was a natural ability or not. We spoke to Dave and them as well. I speak to sports management companies. We don't travel well as South Africans. So we get there, it's miserable weather, it's raining, there's no braai, like you mentioned earlier, to access to. What? How do you zone into that? How do you train somebody on that? Because I think that's one of the biggest missing parts when it comes to taking, I mean, in the top 130, would you agree with me? Let's say the top 10 tennis player. They've all got the skill set.
All have it. At a super level.
At a super level.
At a special, special level.
So that's not what makes you special.
No, that's a minimum requirement these days. So if you want to be a professional golfer, and Arthur, you've been through this whole process and you understand it. I've been on the tennis side, is that you don't become a professional sportsman without talent. That's a given. Yeah, different skill sets in within that pool, but the guy, there's no untalented oak up there who got lucky. You know, it doesn't happen. You go back 20 years, you could probably say a guy there is not as skilled, but the depth has just become, you know, there are oaks around the world by their thousands. And you can just see the guys from the East coming into the golf game now. Kim has just popped up now, and in a short time, there he is, you know, and he's it's just going to get even more so, that the guys at the top will all be super talented. And then you'll have a Federer and a Nadal, the guys that will come around, you know, the Tiger Woods of a era.
Alvarez
is he's on his way. And the difference...
Isn't that mental?
No. Well, some of them are born with it. Like Alcaraz is born with the mental thing already. He's tough as nails from day one.
Tiger Woods' journey. If you look at that journey, it's almost like a military application.
It is. So if you go back, and I can ask Arthur, you know, Arthur, how many hours did you spend on the driving range? How many hours did you spend on the putting green? How many hours did you spend on the short game side? Just in your years, and you go, well, it's X hundreds of thousands of hours.
I wouldn't even be able to pinpoint it.
So call it 1 million hours, just for the sake of it, and say, okay, so how many mental hours training did you do in that time?
It was actually funny. I only started working mentally once I was actually professional, which was totally wrong. But, so when I was a junior golfer, I wasn't the long hitter, right? Like, all the guys would hit it past me, but my short game was the best.
It had to be.
It had to be the best.
Find a way to compete.
So if I'm hitting a 3-wood into a par five and a guy's hitting a 6-iron, I'm not going to hit the green every time, but I'm going to need a chip and putt to make the birdies to be on the 100%. Same level. He hits it to 30 foot. I hit it to, into the bunker, up and down 9.5 out of 10 times, and we've made the same score. But knowing my short game was so good, mentally I was so strong because I had almost like a backbone to my game. I didn't need to panic. I knew I needed to hit it from here to here. When I get to the green, that's my game. I'm going to chip it in. I'm going to make these putts. I'm going to have 24 putts around or 26 putts around. That was normal. But the minute that financial aspect came into it, I almost lost that, call it arrogance, cockiness, or trust in my short game, because now everyone's good. Now you're doing it for a living. Now it almost like you're corp ras.
Yeah.
Now you look for help.
Now I don't know all this noise that is going on in my head. I need help. But it wasn't, going back to him, he had that natural ability of giving that mental aspect to his players without knowing.
Yeah.
I was in that phase when I was a junior. It just happened. But it just, that mental shift switches completely when that money aspect, you're doing it for a living. How am I going to get food on the table the next? Or what? How am
all
I?
The uncertainties.
Yes, and, you know, where am I going to stay? Am I going to stay in a city lodge, or am I going to stay in a Hilton hotel, or, you know, all of those factors?
On a tent.
Or yes.
Drive to Cape Town for a tournament where the others are flying.
But was it ever? Were you exposed to that as you grew up in the professional golf side?
Exposed to the mental side.
Yeah. Did anybody ever come and say, Arthur, are you working on this? Are you? Is your mental part is just as important? Or was it just never there?
I think my dad was a good mentor for me. We spoke about the mental side a lot. But that father-son relationship, there's always that barrier. You know, when he says the things that you don't want to hear, sometimes you almost back off. So that level, that line is drawn between that father and son relationship, I think. I mean, he was just doing it out of love and wanting the best for me. But there is that level of line, I suppose. But I think it got to a point where the game was there, but I needed some sort of assistance, but I actually didn't know what to do. You know, it was getting that white noise out of your head in a particular time. Okay, I'm 6 under par through 10 holes. Let's put up the handbrake. I need to protect the score. You know, that is a difference between me and someone else where, okay, I'm 6 under par, let's go shoot course record, let's get it to 9 or 10, let's see how far it can go.
It's not, you know, don't lose what I have.
Correct, you know, protect what you have, and it's almost like panic. They call it a choke or whatever. Or, okay, I had an average round, I shot 1 over par, cuts 5 under, I need to shoot 6 under. We all know what the cut's going to be after day one.
Yeah.
It's simple to work out. Now, there's that handful of people who will do it 9 out of 10 times because it's not actually a thing where, okay, I get to that point now, panic. Those guys just do it. It's just a mental switch that they do it. They don't panic. They just get it done, job done, box tick. Okay, I'm playing the weekend. Let's go. So that mental aspect is huge. I worked with Marietta Klaassen for quite a while. She was very, very good. She taught me a lot. And then I got to a point where everything was monotonous. Like, there was nothing she could tell me more that I knew about. And funny enough, I don't know if you could relate to it, but I went and saw someone who taught me how to meditate. And meditation is basically controlling your breathing before and on the golf course to get you into the present. Because once you control your heart rate, and you would know, you probably are way better expert than I am, but you get into that calm state where it's just, okay, let's go.
It's slower. It's clearer.
Slower. It's correct. Less panic, I mean, you hear the birds anxiety. In the background and you see the small things and you actually enjoy being out there and not being like, there's just OB and water and everything around me. Let, you know, panic.
Similar to when you're in the zone. You go, correct. How was that? How do I get into that state more? It was so clear. It was so slow. It was so.
Even my father, when I won a couple of tournaments as a junior or whatever, and he said, you know, you were in the zone today. I was like, I get it. Everything just felt slow and normal, but I don't know how I got into that. It just happened. But getting into that zone every single day wasn't comfortable and easy. There's no like, okay, I need to do A, B, C, and D, and I'm in the zone. It takes a lot of time and experience to figure it out, and that's where you need that assistance. So that zone could be a couple of things, but it's such a fine factor, you know what I mean?
There's two things, Arthur, that you mentioned there that I think is very important. The one is that this is back to your original question, is where is the problem? Is that in all those years of junior golf and coming, there was no mental training regime.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when he got to a certain point, he said, I need help. Mm. Okay, so then Marietta helps him. And he answered that question for me. Because sports psychologists are very necessary and do great jobs.
Correct.
He taught you a lot. Then he said, but at some point, I know everything she's going to tell me.
Correct.
And that's where the second gap is. So that's what I specialize in, is not taking the place of a sports psychologist. It's taking Arthur from there and spending time with him inside the ropes, knowing his game, decision-making, what I said about Mary Pierce. You got to think like I think. She teaches you the skills to handle your nerves, the visualization.
It's called a textbook.
Textbook stuff. And then there's the actual go out there and let's go work. So I work with a lot of youngsters at the moment on just this stuff where I go out on the course. I caddy for them once every 3 months. I play 9 holes with them and they have to answer a lot of questions to get into their minds. It's about what are you thinking? What he spoke about is when you get nervous, everyone talks about the process and the result. They all know that if you've had any mental training of any sort, but they don't really understand what it means. Everything he spoke about, getting calm, slowing down your heart rate, your breath, when the result starts playing around, so you 6 under through 10 and you go, don't cock this up, the result is just affect everything in the process.
Around
that one thought. And you now need a mechanism to control that process, although I'm nervous. You are going to get nervous. You're going to be there. You've got a par the 18th. It's a par 5. You can lay up. You're going to be nervous eating a sandwich to a 40 massive square meter green. But I've hit it a million times, but I've never hit it where my head is racing. And if I just two putt and you're already thinking about your speech and don't cock this up. And if I cock this, what are the Oaks going to say? I had a 2-shot lead because I bogeyed 17. And all of that, anything, the result affects the process. And when you're in the zone, it's just process. It's so clear. And all of a sudden, I have a great result.
That's why they always say you don't win a golf tournament in the first round or on the first day, because you're just giving yourself the opportunity to be in that. You might not even be in that position.
Yeah.
You only win the tournament in the last couple of holes knowing, okay, I'm in this. I've got a lead or not. Let's do something about it. Then you've either won it, lost it. Simple. But you cannot win it on day one. You know what I mean?
And the guy who's trying to lead the tournament is under the same stress that the guys who knows he needs to make 2 pars to make the cut.
Mm. Yeah, to pay bills.
So it's correct. Different positions, but the effect of the result on the process is identical. So, you know, we'll talk about Christian a bit later, but working with Christian, I remember day one, just I said to him, you must understand that what you just spoke about is, so the first thing is, oh gosh, I've entered for IGT.
Mm.
These Oaks are professionals. And just, I hope I'm good enough. All of that is a result. So I want to show them I can play. I said, that whole thing is eventually going to be, I can win an IGT. I've got a par the 18th. You got to figure it out. Next thing's going to be tour school. I need to make a par to get my card. I'm going to be on the tour to make my first cut at the Fish River Sun. If I make par on the last, I'm playing. I'm making my first check of $1,200 if I finish last. Then all of a sudden on the last day, I'm 1 shot off the lead. I could win a Sunshine Tour event. Then he goes to European Q School, where I caddied for him. And then eventually we're sitting here today where 2 days ago he was announced for President's Cup, but knowing that the playoffs in the FedEx Cup, Emil Mann is there commentating and watching, trying to decide whether he's going to pick Christian or pick A, B, or C as a captain's pick. He knows he's playing right now for the President's Cup. And I told him back then that someday you'll be playing to make the President's Cup. And I said, and it will come, you'll be in possibly winning a major with 9 holes to go, you'll be top of the leaderboard. You're going to crap yourself the same way you crapped yourself on the first tee day one of an IGT at Wingate. But the process is affected by some result, and that mechanism. If I say to him, you've got to lie there that's sitting down with the grass going this way, you've got 110 meters, he's going to say, this is not great, but I've seen this before. I know what to do. I'm going to do this in my stance. I'm going to do this, and I'm going to play for that, and the ball's going to release. And I said, well, how did you know that? Because he's been doing it since he's 5 years old. He never thought about it when he was 9 or 10. Then at 14, someone said, let's take a look at a flyer lie. How can you hit wedge there? It's a flyer. I hit it straight over the green again. Well, he learned that this thing's going to go 15 yards further because of the lie. I'll hit a gap wedge. It's the same there, that when that situation comes, these are my tools.
That's where that fearless factor comes, when they, you know, say when you're a kid, you have these certain lies or things in front of you, but you almost don't have the mental capability of accepting it and analyzing it and trying to make it happen. You choose your club. This is the distance. I hit it. Then you go in the same position 10 years later and money's involved, or I need to make a par birdie to make the cut. Now your head is just going crazy. The grass is against the grain. I've got water short or right. Am I going to leave my club face open or closed because it's in the rough? All of those factors is actually shouldn't be there, but you've just created it for you because of the result.
If it was 5 days earlier in the practice round, you would have walked up there and said, this is not a wedge, this is a gap wedge, this is going to jump.
And probably hit it to 5 foot.
Then you get it 5 days later, and afterwards you're going, what was I thinking? Mm. But at that moment, you were going 140 down the highway, and things just happen. It's always afterwards you go, where did that all go the last 3 holes? You know, and then you think about stuff, and I just couldn't control my mind. So back to Arthur's. So when Arthur was getting, saying, I need help, and it's not help, I'm sick. I need more weapons. I need a skill. So Marietta helps him get a skill. And at that point, when he says, I think I've got this, I think I'm a better golfer for it, I can say to him, so again, you've got the 10,000 hour rule is still there in terms of short game driving. You've got all of it, ticket all. But on the mental space, you don't have the 10,000 hours. Mm. You have the knowledge. So now you have a professional golfer with a super amateur mental preparation and hours under the belt. Mm. Because we don't, we should have started working with him with mental when he was 12. Mm. At a completely different level. I don't talk to you about your short game when you're 12 the way I do when you're a professional. You saw that little video that Phil made just about wedges,
yeah,
and the lie. I'm going, that's a whole hour worth on the type of lie he gets, that the shot he's going to hit. How far is he take? I go up there and I go, well, is it going to jump or not going to jump? You'll take it further. You were a professional. Which way is the grain? What's happening? Mm. What's the club face? If it's this way, it should close on me. Or
is the grass wet? Is it dry?
There we go. So what happens when the ball's wet? Is it going to spin, not spin? Well, those are things that he's taken further than I do when I'm a single handicapper to go, but pro. But the 10,000 hours of the mental skill that he has is not there. When he hits his wedge, he's nervous and he hits a decent wedge and he goes, yeah, but I mean, cheapers, I've been doing it. I should be able to do it. But then when he fails mentally, he goes, but I'm paying someone, I'm learning, I'm doing this, but it's still not working. Because the white noise and the head spinning, why? Because you don't have 10,000 hours in battle.
Mm.
And that's where we're failing right now.
100%.
That's where we're failing in junior golf right now. It's all these great kids, all this, but there's zero mental help.
And it's still to this day like that.
And it can be simple. It's not at the level of a pro. It's not Dustin Johnson who goes and sees someone and comes back 6 months later, I'm a new man because of this person. It's not that. It's the same way that he's worked and his short game has developed over years and gone little left, little right, and has matured, and, you know, and finally he's come to a point where this is how I approach it. And you're not going to make major changes to the way you chip. There might be small things you learn and you try, but you have this mental thing, it's great. You have all the information. You know what to do with it. But you don't have 10,000 hours in battle.
I think there's two coaches right now in South Africa, and please don't shoot me for not mentioning some other guys. But I think there's two guys, potentially three guys actually, now that I think of it. But I'll mention the two. One guy, Nico van Rensburg. Another guy, Grant Veenstra. They've both got playing backgrounds from the tour. They are really maturing the young generation of today. The Christian Maas, for example.
Casey Jarvis.
I think Grant's worked with Christian, if I'm not mistaken.
They're working right now.
Yes, and some other guys. And because they've got that experience, you would call it on the field, on the golf course, okay, they've got that edge. They can tap into someone's brain because they've been there, done that before. Which is a great thing because they're using the opportunity that they've learned in life, in golf, on tour, They know what to say. They've been there, done that, had the same feeling as you.
They
you
know
feeling?
What it feels like.
They've got that feeling.
When you lose all confidence Correct. And wonder, can I hit a wedge on the green? I mean, why would you even think that?
And but those guys are doing it well. Doug Wood is another guy for an example. But they are starting to look after the younger generation right now and create, I would hope to say, superstars. Because they've been there, done that, experienced it, and they can tap into that person's brain and tap into those feelings.
So it's interesting that you mentioned Nico there at Silver Lakes is where I'm a member. So yeah. I work with one or two of his students. And again, now I've just touched on it. So Nico is building the guy's swing. He's technical and they play on the course. And he talks to the guy and he does. So,
course management.
So it's starting already. Then he comes and he spends time with me. And Nico and I, we work together. I'm not trying to take Nico's skill that you've just mentioned out of it. But I add a different dimension to the kid and we'll spend time on playing nine holes or we'd sit in a coffee shop and talk about certain things that he doesn't want to talk to Nico about or his father or his opponents and say when I stand there, I crap myself. Because you don't say that. I mean, I'm the number one junior in the country. Why would I crap myself with a sandwich on the 18th? Well, they do.
Yeah.
And they get a space where they're safe, where if you don't confront your fears, if you don't put them on the table and say, that's my weakness. So let's find a way to address it, but say, no, I'm fine. No, I didn't get nervous. It was just a bad swing. I'm like, that swing went all over. That was because your body didn't respond because you were
stuck. Yeah.
There we go. So don't talk nonsense to me. I'm Mike. I get nervous when I'm leading a tournament. That's where it starts. Yeah.
You don't strike it for 18 holes and it's the last hole of the day because you're leading and it just
Mito
came out
Pereira didn't need that skiddy drive down to the right into the slot because he just made a bad swing. He was about to win a major.
And he
couldn't deal with it. And hopefully he'll win a lot and play a great President's Cup. But there's an example of a top golfer who was exposed in a position that he hadn't been in before. And you get Justin Thomas, who's all over the place making triples, and he made a 5 and a 6 on that par 3. And next thing, he's winning the major because he just plugged away at what he does. He knows people get nervous up the stretch. Let me go 2 or 3 under on the back nine. They might come 2 or 3 towards me. That's 6 shots. And it all worked out that way. He didn't know it would. Some other day, he would have lost that by 2 or 3 and said, well, I made a good charge.
Well, look at Will Zalatoris.
Yeah.
He had that, what is the right word for it? That thing in the back of his head that I'm a top 10 player in the world, but I haven't won a tournament. A major contender the whole time, but can't get the job done.
Formula One.
The tournament that he won, he almost cocked it up. He got the luckiest break I've seen
hits it in the water there with that pitch shot.
And it, yeah, his opponent hit it in the water. He plays next.
He follows it.
He follows it, and it bounced on the stones and luckily finished between the grass and the stone. But telling you now, that whole thing inside his head was, here's my opportunity, don't cock it up.
And maybe getting over that hurdle finally might now just accelerate him and free him up.
All my critics to say I can win a tournament now. That all those things were running through.
There was just a retirement in Formula One. He's never won a Formula One. He was Mercedes driver. And when he spoke afterwards, he was like, that mental capacity, I never got over it. So he walked away from one of the best cars in the world, and he's never won.
So that's a good example. So Formula One driver who's never won will go into the final lap 5 seconds up, and all he's thinking is, don't cock it up. Don't go too sharp. Where Max Verstappen goes into it and goes, I'm going to nail it 17 more bends,
and
I'm winning. There's no ways they're catching me. He doesn't even entertain the thought that he might cock it up.
Yes.
The other guy goes, don't cock it up. And he'll finish 2 seconds ahead because he's going to scoot it around there and try not to, you know, put on the power too soon or get the line wrong or whatever it is, which he's done perfectly for 71 laps. And on the 72nd lap, he goes, "Wayata." Because the result of winning his first has just affected the process.
So it's like an amateur having a halfway beer. Because we see it all the time.
That is so easy to talk about because he's technically meditating his body state
I didn't want to cheapen that process a halfway beer. But I see it all the time.
That's the way
it works. Guy shoots a 47, has two halfway beers, And he shoots a 41.
You know how many pros would like to come up the 17th, get to the 17th tee box with a one-shot lead and say, can I have a beer, wait 10 minutes, and then play these last two holes. But it's illegal.
I've experienced myself. I was playing in a Sunshine tournament in Zambia, and I'm not going to mention any names. I'm not going to be that guy. Okay.
It happens.
It happens.
We all know.
And anyway, so I teed off in the morning. He was the final group. He had a couple of shot lead. Sign my scorecard, go get a Coke and order some chow. See this oak. He's ordering Coke and brandy and he's putting in his juice bottle. So I say to him, but listen, I'm not following the leaderboard, doing my own thing. So how was your day? No, bro, I'm about to tee off in 30 minutes. He's just downed a double brandy and Coke and he's put it in his bottle to just take away that edge.
Yeah.
And it was unreal. I mean, you're not supposed to do that. I'm not going to ever mention his name. It happened. But
That's the idea.
I get it.
But isn't it, am I again cheapening the process by saying, so in my own offices, I've got a marketing people with master degrees. They walk in here, they're basically useless. Because they've got some foundation, but now the experience comes into play. Now, the first time they've got some experience, then the first time I sit in front of a customer, they sound like they started work in their life yesterday. No idea what they're talking about. Nerves are all over the place. And we focus a lot on making sure that you deliver the message in the right way, but you need to prepare for the circumstances. So know what you're walking into. What could potentially take you off the ball or spin you a little bit to the left where it takes you off your consciousness. That to me, and it's just amazing to me that being in the golf industry, I don't see a lot of focus or mention about that. It's almost like it's still a taboo subject? I don't want to say taboo subject, but why isn't it part of the big focus? Because every amateur, this is what we always discuss. We all know that they've got the skills at the top, but we talk about, okay, well, he's going to choke. He's going to choke on the Sunday because history says he's going to choke at some stage.
And those oaks that you know, that you all know them, they're great. Why hasn't he done better? Because he's a great player. And eventually at the age of 39, he'll win his first Sunshine Tour event.
Correct.
Because he's not caring or what?
Well, he matured, other things in life. He got a family.
Yeah.
Probably has a side job. And I'm not going to mention names.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, it frees him up a little bit. And he still gets nervous, but he somehow gets over there where he's got 17 seconds, where 16 of them, he probably cocked it up. Mm. He should have won it comfortably. And you know those guys.
Yeah.
So the other guy's got a great wedge game. Another guy's got a great mental ability. And some guys don't have a great wedge game. And some don't have a great mental ability, but the guy with a bad wedge game can find someone who will give him some technique. He might not stick it to 10 foot every time, but he won't miss greens.
It's like Sean Norris.
There's a man next door. I mean, I see him all the time.
But he's...
Wins Stain City putting from within 40, 50 foot of the green every time and wins a European Tour event. And he says, I practice it all the time. That's the way I play.
And he's lost that. We've chatted about this before. He's lost that stigma. I zero F's given what other people think of how I putt.
He does not care.
Yeah.
Does not care. He went through a phase where he did care and he did nothing, even though he was great. I'm not saying he did nothing.
You're absolutely right. So 10, 12 years ago, I was on the 13th of Leopard Creek. And Sean was on the Sunday playing with, I was walking with Chart van der Walt. It was a mate of mine, and Sean I didn't know actually at that time, other than I. And now I know him very well. But they were both at lying eighth. And at that time, the eighth paycheck was 400,000 rand. So they needed to get home roughly in that spot. And Sean, this was a big thing.
Okay,
because he had won the Nashua Masters when he was a youngster, and after that, nothing really. And everyone
probably
said,
won 80, 90, 100 grand.
Yeah, and they all said, this guy is the next big thing, is the big thing. And anyway, so Shawnee, on 13, it is layup up to the right, and it funneled down to just end up right there, short of the green where most of the guys go. And the pin was back right. So you need to hit this little 40-meter clip shot that you hit left of the flag, and if you hit it properly, it checks and it funnels into that little collection area. And I'm looking at that going, I don't think Sean can hit the middle of the green with any kind of wedge. Mm. So he walks up there, looks around, goes back, takes out the long putter, rolls it to the middle of the green, puts it down into the mound and taps it in for his par and walks off to the next and finishes eighth and wins 400,000 rand. And everyone says, every other pro in the field would have chipped that. But if he gums that and puts it in the pothole, in the pot, he probably ends 12th, 14th,
20th.
20th yeah. and gets 80,000 yeah. rand. But he knew that he was probably giving up a stroke to the field, but he did what he knew. Now he's perfected that. And he's now winning tournaments around the world. He's 70 in the world, 80 in the world. He doesn't care. He says, that's my weakness. Go find something that I can compete with. So mentally, he doesn't care what people think. Because if you take it and you go, wonder what Rory's thinking. That's a result affecting my pro. He goes up there. He's got the putter out at Stain City, walking down the hill there at the bottom. And Kyle,
I think that was 15.
15 over the back. He went over there and he's walking there and he's got to hit it 40 foot up the hill with some rough, then some shaved, then onto the green. He put it to 4 foot.
I'll give you 50 balls.
And he drained the
putter.
Yeah.
And you probably will put maybe one there by fluke.
So I asked him about it. And he said, you know what? You know how many of those shots I've hit in my life? The same as the oak who hits the one check stop. I know exactly how to put that within 4 foot. And Sean does not miss a 4 foot putt.
I was just
so that's another skill he added to
a
that.
A 15-foot putt for Sean is like a 5-foot like putt 100. For a normal player.
So he said...
And a normal professional.
No, so, yes.
Normal professional.
So a normal professional says inside 3 foot, that's a up and down. Gimme. Gimme. Sean says, I'll become the best 6-foot putter that the country... And he probably is the best 6-foot putter that South Africa's produced.
Him and Harding. Is it also because he has to read the putts well?
No, that's a whole skill, but he developed that to a level. Then he says, now if I'm not chipping... You can't chip that putter to 3 foot every time. But
you
can get it.
One out of 20.
Yeah,
times.
But he can get it to 6, 7, 8 foot every time, which means it's 16 foot when he's looking at the flag. And he's making 9.5 out of 10 8 footers and 6 footers. And he says, that's how I do it. So he developed a skill around the choice he's made. Not say, I'm a professional, I have to chip and chip, be a bad chipper.
And that's also, that gets to a point for like Sean or for a good putter like Justin Harding, that freedom knowing that you can put me around the green and I know I can get the ball to 8 foot and make it 9.5 the time. That freedom inside, you've got no panic to hit the green anymore. You almost just go and free flow.
Yeah, it goes back in your game. So
it goes
easier.
Back in your game.
Now I don't have to hit fairways because if I just get it close up to the green, I'll putt it up and make an 8 footer. So it frees you up.
Going backwards.
Backwards.
You could be the worst driver in the world and the best putter in the world, and you can make a very good...
Sean used to stand there 240 out, and he goes, every other pro is going for the green with a 5-wood or with whatever it is that you're hitting, and he goes, I must either lay this to 80 yards, or I must get it in the bunker. And if I can't do that, I'm screwed. I'm making par. Yeah, or hit the green perfectly. That's always there. Then I make birdie or eagle. But if he misses the sand, he is making par, which is a loss. So if he lays it back... At least he'll make 4 or 5 out of 10 from 80 yards. He'll make birdie. Now, pro, you know, now he says, hit it up there. I'll putt it up there and I'll have a birdie putt inside 8 foot. And I can't hit my wedge to 8 foot every time. So knock it up there. And he's decent out of the bunker and he putts well. So again, it's a mental state. And he mentioned it that he doesn't care because he said, this is what I'm doing. I win tournaments this way, so I don't care what you think. And what you think is a result when you're young, what my mates think, what the other pro, you can't chip. The guys, they walk, they play with you in the three ball in the sunshine, 20, miss a green, you can see those going, now watch this. Because they know you can't chip.
But it's normally the businessman also that stops caring about what the world says and how you're supposed to do it that eventually just makes it out of freedom. You said, so Mariette was the coach that you worked with. Mariette Klaassen. And Mike, you said something about joining them inside the rope. And I just wanted to explore that for a minute. Because you obviously got mental coaching or mental advice, whatever you want to position it as. But there is a difference between, I see on coaching. So on-course coaching has become very popular. Luelen Luan really does it a lot now at the moment. Because we as amateurs, we go there and we say, Luelen, I had such a good session with you. But then when I get to the course, it's almost like that's all goes missing. And now,
but why? Why? Because it's a process that you've worked on.
Yeah.
And then everything affects that process.
100%.
So on the range, it's just the process.
Exactly. And I know amateurs, we don't relate in the same way or even want to say, but we experience ourselves. We go onto the range. I mean, we are belting those things. It feels like I can say 1 meter to the left, that's where I'm going to land it. And 90% of the time, that's exactly what I do. I get on the exact same shot 2 holes down the road. No idea what I'm
Zero on the range.
100%.
If you duff it, shank it, hit it to your target, there's another one waiting for you.
100%. And there's no there's no, except maybe your friend's bet that you lose or the handicap that you're concerned about, there's no real...
So Arthur will know. If I take Arthur to the range and I say, hit 10 wedges, and Arthur hits 10 wedges, I say, how are your wedges? He says, I'm hitting my wedges really well. But he might have pulled one or he might have been five, but he feels like out of those 10, then I take him onto the course and I put him down 10 times. 10 times one is a lot different to hitting 10 wedges on the range and saying, I'm hitting my wedges well.
Okay.
Go hit 10 one wedges, two pins. And then I say, you know that you averaged 34 foot with a gap wedge. And he's going to go, that's not good enough.
No, it's not good enough.
You see what I'm saying? So okay. He might say, so the first one you hit was very good. The second one was terrible. The third one was okay. Fourth was okay. Very good. On the range, you hit them and you're working on a process. For example, I'm going to put that ball in here to not get disconnect. And you're not even, you're kind of hitting them there, but you're saying I had a great wedge session because the process that I was working on, I think I achieved it. I'm now not disconnecting.
I hear what you're saying.
You see?
Okay, I just
and
what you,
and
okay.
There's a big difference between 10 and 10 times 1. When it matters.
Well, the thing is, that's why they say golf is one of the hardest sports. I was very good at tennis and golf, funny enough, as well. And
well, paddle tennis today, Arthur.
Paddle tennis is even better. I played at 6 o'clock this morning. It was unreal. But the nice thing about, and I don't want to compare tennis to golf, but tennis, you've got opportunities. You can lose 3 points and still win the game.
You can lose a set.
You can lose a set and still win the game. You can miss your first serve and still be in the point. With golf, you cock it up once, you've cocked the whole game up. That is the difference between, okay, tennis and golf. I don't want to compare.
There are many pluses and minuses, but the one you're touching on there is a really difficult thing in golf.
That's a very difficult thing to get
which
right.
Which tennis has very easy.
Correct.
I played it both.
There's thousands of good tennis professionals out there that are sitting in 300 to 500 in the world that could probably beat the top 50 player in the world. They just, it's so hard to break it through. I've got friends who are there right now.
The system is
the
tough.
The system is very tough to break through.
Where 300 in the world can win a PGA Tour event tomorrow.
Correct. Okay, you hear what you're saying in the context.
And back to that 300 in the tennis, even if he gets into the US Open, is not beating Nadal and Djokovic and those guys, where in golf it can happen.
Yeah.
Correct.
So I play a lot of the senior amateur circuit. You know, I'm trying to get into tournaments and figure out how this works because I loved my tennis. And that's the hardest thing for me is that in tennis, no matter what happened the first 30 minutes, I was still going to win the match.
Mm.
If I get off to a good start, I'm going to thump you. If I don't, I was mentally, I was an animal. There's no ways. You're never beating me. It's just a matter of time. So we're in golf where if I make a double bogey on the first hole, they can't wait to take a permanent marker and write it on my forehead and leave it there for 4 days. And no matter how many birdies I make, that doesn't go away. Because then I make 4 birdies and I'm 2 under. Yeah, but you could have been 4 under.
Could have been 4 under.
Where in tennis, I lose the set. And it's not, oh, well, you've now won the next set, but you said, no, you're now ahead. Now you're leading. Yeah. You serve 3 double faults, love 40. Doesn't mean I'm not going to hold serve.
Mm.
But try and hit 2 OB and see how you still get par.
Mm.
Because in tennis, holding serve is par. Correct. Breaking is making birdie.
Yeah. Correct.
Then you're ahead. So hit 3 OB and try and make par. I can serve 3 double faults and still hold serve and be 1 love. I made par.
Yeah.
And you're up.
And no one writes it in permanent marker. They do write love 40 in pencil. And then sometimes they have to bring the marker and write it, you've lost the game. But quite often you can just wipe it out and no one talks about it.
So are you saying that... Oh, sorry, Arthur.
Carry on.
Are you then saying that if youngsters are listening to this right now, or even professionals that's on the tour at the moment, because we always think that they think about everything you're supposed to think about. You always think that they have the team around them to always bring that to their attention. But there's something for me on taking it inside the rope, as Mike said it, about giving them the mental capacity when they're on the course, when they're playing in a tournament. Because we never we prepare them through a telephone call or a half an hour session, but we're never there on the moment that something happens. So taking that mental capacity inside the light or onto the field, is that sort of where you think it's going, Mike?
I just, you know, if I had to summarize all of this, and Arthur has now said a lot of things from a player point of view, brings it right back to what we're saying, and he's experienced it firsthand. And I'm experienced it right now as an amateur golfer from the tennis world, and it's tough. It helps me when I work with the youngsters, but it's the things I said. There's two things that stand out for me. There's no mental coaching that happens from a young age continuously through the career as they move up in the ranks and eventually turn pro. Okay, it's when you get really good, then, oh, I better start doing some mental stuff because that's what the pros do. I need to have that, okay? And you master it, but you don't have 10,000 hours in the battlefield.
So you don't have you don't have that mental belief.
Belief, experience, say, whatever. And the second thing is, it has two parts. The one is the Marietta class, and to understand sports psychology, help you understand that. And he says, eventually it took me a while, but after a while, I've got it all now. I've got the theory. You can tell me another 100 times, but I understand 90% of it, okay? And the rest I'm not going to use. That's how you sift through it.
Yes.
And then it's the application of it, understanding the person, the way he thinks, the way he reacts. We don't all react the same when I get emotional, when I get nervous, when I get scared, when I get cocky. I need to say, you know, but tone it back. You think you're on a roll. You're going to cock it up as you're going over the top.
Yeah.
It's all about understand. That only comes with the 10,000 hours in the battlefield. You got to cock it up a few times to know that the warning lights are there. And that's the first great step, is to see the warning lights and start reacting to it. Am I always going to hold on to that one-shot lead because of my training? No, because I don't hit every wedge perfectly because of my mental training. Even under pressure, the best guys cock it up. But I'm going to hold on to that one-shot lead a lot more often than when I don't have that as a mechanism to use.
A tool.
I say to him, look at this lie in the bunker. And he's going to talk to you for a minute about all the things that lie is telling him. And then he relates it to the technique that he has to use, the club that he has to use, depending on the flag and what he needs to do. And then he's going to execute it. Why? Because he's trained that technique. And not just on the driving range. In tournaments, he's had this before. And that's giving him the belief that he actually has a chance to up and down this. Now I give him a mental situation. And I say, talk to me about it for a minute. And he goes, I don't know. I've got a knife and I'm in a gunfight.
Okay, yeah, 100%.
So in the beginning, we give the guy a gun. Maybe he has a pellet gun against the AK-47, but he feels he's in the fight.
Yeah.
And sometimes he pops the oak in the eye and he wins. And he goes, holy cow, that worked. Gives him confidence. Or he gets gunned down, but he was in the fight and he felt he had something to fight with. Next time he comes around, now he has a fucking 9mm. And he uses his 9mm. Eventually he gets to a point where, as you in your golf game develop, I've got my own semi-automatic Uzi and I'm going to take you down. Yeah. You point a gun at me, you're going down. And sometimes you get shot, but most of the time you win the fight. And too many of our good young golfers are just exposed where they don't have the tool. They don't know where to go when that happens. So they just kind of stand there like they're in front of a firing squad.
And is there a difference in the bullets or the gun that you have to go and play that? Is there a difference between loading that for ladies versus men?
No. That is not the tool that you use, but how, and that's where I like to work, is he differs from other men. Okay. There might be stereotypes. I'll say, Arthur is like X, so I kind of know what we need to do. And then you have males and females, and 90% of females are the same, and 90% of men. And then you have men that are more emotional and more that can't detach, and women that just don't care emotionally, so they react differently. But there are female ways of looking things and male things, and then within that there's different groupings. You get super cocky guys. You get guys like who pretend to not care. Nick Kyrgios.
He uses his cocky attitude to put the player off, number one.
Yeah, for sure. Pisses off the field.
And it ignites a fire in him. I wanted to ask you about Nick Kyrgios because that's my interpretation of him. When I first looked at him, I thought he was the biggest doer in the world because he was just behaving like a child. Then I thought maybe in 4 or 5 years' time he'll grow up and be a world beater. He's still the same oak from 5, 6, 7 years ago, however long he's been playing. He hasn't changed, but I think he uses that to his benefit as a tactic against his opponent and some sort of spark.
Defense mechanism? Or
I think there's a massive defense mechanism in there where he just doesn't want to... he uses all of his reactions in the way like a naughty child because he doesn't sometimes want to say, that's the best I have and I got beat.
Yeah.
So he uses that as I've stuffed this, yokes are cocking around, you're cheating me. And he goes, so now I watched him play this morning because they played into the night. So he was playing Karen Khachanov and they got into the fifth set at 8 o'clock this morning Well, it was actually so the guy picked me up at 20 past 7. So let's say at 7 o'clock, I watched the last three games of the match. And Kyrgios was totally on it. He was keeping his cool. And then he loses his serve at 3-2. And I'm expecting him to go. So he is maturing because he thinks he now could actually win a major. So then this all goes on and he holds his cool and he starts chirping his box, but he doesn't lose it. And he's very competitive. Almost broke back, but he doesn't. And then he holds serve. Then finally Khachanov holds serve and time runs out. And he loses in the fifth. Shakes hand, walks. Then goes to his bag, takes a racket and smashes it six times and then tosses it onto the center court. Goes back to his bag, takes a new racket, smashes it twice and tosses it, takes his bag and walks off the court.
So
he actually tried to do the right thing. Correct. Maybe that behavior will get me the win. You know, if I'm not the idiot.
I hear you.
And so, you know, if he was honest, and he never would be, then he'd say, I've got massive insecurities. And that's why I perform the way I do, because I don't care. Tennis is just a sport. I don't care. Yeah, you should have won five majors by now. It's not about that. I don't care. I don't play tennis for money. I just,
I don't have the natural ability. I've just got a couple of...
At Wimbledon, he says, that's not competitive stuff. He must stop complaining that I put him off. He's not mentally tough. I'll tell you what's mentally tough. The guy I played two-on-two basketball with in Australia. Those are mentally tough guys. What's he on about? That's Tsitsipas he was talking about, by the way. So he's always covering up his behavior, but if he had to sit down and go, jeepers, what if I really practice hard and I really don't moan and I don't throw my rackets and I don't make it into the top 10 in the world? What does that say?
That zone.
Am I actually not that good? So let's not go there. Let's throw parachutes out there. Let's not take the parachutes away. So that's just me analyzing him without knowing him. So that's a guess. But I've played, you know, worked with a lot of sportsmen, and Kyrgios fits into a certain category that I've dealt with. And I think Arthur's not far off in assessing, you know, from a distance, and I think you're close. Is he talented? He's not talented. He's super talented. He's super talented. He is the guy right now that should win this US Open, and he's not. He lost this morning without Djokovic there. So I'm saying, and without Zverev, who with that ankle injury, he would have won, I think, had a very good chance with Djokovic to win this US Open. And then Kyrgios. And Kyrgios showed it at Wimbledon where he got through the cracks. And then he was like, hey, let me start behaving. Let me start trying. Maybe I can win one. Because don't tell me, he says, I don't give a damn if I win a major. It's not about that. I'm here to do the twak, man. He's there to win. He'd like to win 10 majors. But he can't say it because then he's going to come up short.
Yeah, and it goes against these.
If they asked him, they asked because I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't care. It's just tennis. I don't even like playing. Like with COVID, he said, "I'm staying in Australia. I'm not traveling." You know, he's full of it.
I think. Correct me if I'm wrong. You know the tennis players more, but I think he's got more talent than Djokovic. Djokovic has put in the hours. He's grinded. And I might sound like the biggest doers by saying that, but the things that Kyrgios can pull off.
I won't disagree with you. I think if you're just talking raw talent, undoubtedly. Djokovic has got a crap load of talent. And A, there's no one who moves as well as he does. There's no one as mentally tough as he is. And he's perfected his skills to a level of repetition that he's sick under pressure that he can go to the well. So that is a whole different set of talents right there. Dedication, persistence, belief.
Hard work.
And under pressure saying, I will do this. It's not if I'm in it, I'm going to do it. Where Kyrgios, just raw talent. If you had the ingredients on the table, his cake would have a lot more ingredients than Djokovic's.
It's crazy. They
both have a lot. But you don't get to where Djokovic is just with a bit of luck, you know. But raw talent. Tennis hasn't seen the last raw talent like that was probably Boris Becker. So Boris Becker, if you watched him play, he was phenomenal. You go to the practice court. That's where you get your value for money. And see what you can do with a ball. You know a lot of golfers like that. If they could play exhibitions and they could mess around and trick shots, and you go, holy cow, that's not what wins tournaments. It's a high level of skill, but discipline, controlling the mind, the emotion, decision making, when do I go for it, when do I back off, there's a whole package. And Kyrgios in the one corner, it says raw talent, he's probably number one. And then he scores quite low out of 10 in a lot of other areas. He's a great athlete. There's a lot of other good stuff. He's not just a raw talent. He serves probably one of the best on the tour right now.
But what I've gathered with you is I think there is a an exuberant amount of knowledge in the psychology aspect of what you've experienced over the last amount of years. So you could call yourself a psychologist without that qualification. You could probably teach more to someone than an actual textbook psychologist would be. Would you consider yourself that type of person, like, hey, I'm good at this, I could get paid for this? Or you are doing that or not?
I would not ever call myself a psychologist because I respect the field and what they do and what they contribute. And I think I touched on that with you specifically because I think there's a real need for those people and they do a great job. What I do believe is that in that mental space, I have a lot to offer, which you don't find in a textbook and which you won't find from a traditional sports psychologist. Mm. And it's stuff that just came into my head because that's the way my tennis developed. So I experienced it in a skill level. Mental side was a lot higher than the guys I were competing against. And then through the course of my coaching, working with a Mary Pierce, a Amanda Kutzer, Martina Navratilova, and all the other people across, and eventually getting to a guy like Christian Bezuidenhout. And that skill that I had got developed and refined to the professional world of really working with the top guys. And I don't mean just top professional, top amateur, top a guy that's at the top of his skill at the point that he is. So if it's a youngster, then I can help any youngster, but I can help the best 12-year-old a lot, and I can help the best 18 and the best professional because he's at the top of his skill level at that stage of his life. So can I get paid for that? Yes, and I do. Okay. I do get paid, and I have worked with different professionals and amateurs, and more so with amateurs because that's where they actually need it, because I'm not touring out there. I'm not going to go onto the tour, but I've worked with a lot of professional sportsmen that have come to see me and spend time with me on short-term basis and longer-term basis, and they pay me for it. And I don't charge them a hell of a lot, but I say to them up front, you're going to pay for this because there's a value to it for you. So that you don't keep canceling your next appointment and I'm going to bill you for it. And it's not about charging you X per hour because that's what I think I'm worth. I don't. It's a nominal fee, but it's something that you commit to.
And it's not because it's an X type of person, i.e. a Christian Bezuidenhout or a Pete at
Correct.
Silver Lake.
It's yeah.
It doesn't matter who
doesn't
you
matter.
Are.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. So do I believe I have a skill? Yes. Can I make a difference and even sell it? Yes. Do I actively pursue it? No, because I'm busy with other things. But every time I get contacted, then without helping myself, I say yes, because I enjoy helping people and I enjoy seeing an Arthur as he is right now. If I work with him for a couple of weeks, I haven't changed his skill sets dramatically, but all of a sudden he's getting more out of his skill set because he's in all the things you spoke about earlier. Mm. You're more clear, you're more quiet, you're more this, and then you perform. Mm. And I like to do it next to a sports psychologist. So not working with one, but in the information they give you. And I know where my secret lies. And it's in the process of actually competing. I spend Sunday 3 hours driving with a youngster playing a tournament. So I drove in a cart and just watched him for 3 hours. And I watch him closely and I see the situation. I know his score. I know what the leaderboard. I'm watching the app. He knows it because his father is feeding him information. I see how things change. Just steps onto the first tee. He's from Silver Lakes. He thinks he should win the tournament. And I can just see the anxiousness playing. Not nerves. I need to birdie. I need to get air because I should shoot about 5 under here and I should do this quite comfortably. In the end, he shoots 1 or 2 under and he actually did really well to turn it around because he made a stupid double fault. A double fault. There we go. That's tennis and golf together. Double going OB on the one hole, trying something, which was a stupid decision, and then a bad execution on top of it. And then he started chasing the game. So all the classics that you've seen in golf, but I had all of that there, and all I did was watch and watch and watch. And now we've got a lot to talk about afterwards. And he just did really well in a tournament in Natal. Finished second or third in the stroke play and made it to the semis of the match play and beat some really good players. And then was up with 4 holes to go. And the day before, he birdied 4 of the last 5 holes in the quarters. And then he actually bogeyed 4 of the last 5 to lose 1 down. He was up. And why? Because all of a sudden, there's a semi or a final on the line of a big tournament. winning the round of 32s or the 16s is not that big because I've done that before. Now he's getting where he could actually and just that thought of down the stretch, I'm there, I'm two up on this guy. Most people would say I shouldn't beat him, and there's four or five holes left, and he makes four bogeys in a row. And he was averaging 3-4 under every day. And at that point, he was probably, I think he was 2 or 3 under and ended up shooting 2 over. Doesn't matter. The other guy also matched him with a stupid bogey on another hole, so he almost got away with it. Mm. But why did it change? And that's the area that I want, is that thing that you say when you stand there, why am I feeling like this now? Mm. You know, it's not because I'm nervous of hitting a wedge on the green.
It's not like you've smelt something and now your senses are heightened with all the obstacles
doesn't
around you.
Doesn't work that way. Doesn't work. Or something in the water, you know.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's a fun space. I really enjoy that space because it's an abstract space. It's not something that I can see and go to and change your grip. And you've got to understand a philosophy. You've got to think about your own life. Your perspective often determines where we're going to come in on because how did you grow up?
Mm.
What kind of parents did you have when you were a junior? Were they great and supportive? Were they the oaks who fucking put so much pressure on you? Were they the that gave you a beating if you made more than two bogeys? Or, you know, or did you have a coach that was just a father figure? Or, you know, there's so many things that you need to. Mm. And all of that tells us where the pieces come together.
Mm.
I say something to you and I say something to him and you guys react differently to it because of your point of reference, you know, everything that's happened. And in sport, we think guys are bulletproof because they are heroes. But they're also humans. They also have lives. They also came correct from somewhere. They also have relationships that didn't work and disappointments. And when he walks onto that first tee, he can't leave it all at home. It's part of the person standing on the first tee. With women, sometimes it's a little more difficult because they struggle to emotionally detach.
Yes.
Where men can, you know, I always use this stupid example when I was coaching. If you coach a lady and a half an hour before her match, her boyfriend says something to her that just wasn't the right thing and they get in a fight. She goes onto court and she's leading 5-love in the first set and on the changeover, and you've seen this on TV, she puts the towel over her head and she's crying.
Yeah.
And they go, well, then, I mean, she's leading 5-love, but she's still busy with this boyfriend. It's emotionally hard to detach. Where the guy has a fight the other way around, and then they call him for his match at the French Open, and he walks out. The minute he walks on the court and he sees you, he goes, I'm going to kick that guy's ass. That's my job.
He's left it behind.
And he gets fired up, and he does it. He comes off, and everyone's congratulating him. The girlfriend comes, hey, honey, like, and he goes, hey. And he picks it up right there. I'm not done with you yet because I don't think you understand.
Yes.
And he just switches on and he switches off. So, again, that's in general. Some men are more emotional, so it's not that easy to detach, but the bulk detach quite easily. Where their egos are different. So I've got to tell Arthur that when he plays a great round of golf or a great tennis match, he goes, I was amazing. And I go, you were, but you're actually good. But there's a few things we need to talk, because if you play Christian tomorrow, you're going to get your ass handed to you because there's a few things you're not seeing. You're riding the wave.
Yeah.
A girl plays an amazing match and you say, well, she goes, I was okay. So you're always building them up and you're bringing the guys back a little bit so the ego doesn't cost the process. Where the girl, the emotions are telling her that everything is okay. She serves one double fault in that. She says, my serve was crap because on that point it was break point and the whole crowd sat there and how can a pro not hit a second serve? A guy serves 17, he tells you about that AC hit on break point.
Mm.
You go, buddy, you had a 27% second serve percentage. We need to get to the court. He goes, did you check that ace? I just smoked on break point. That oak thought he had me. And that's all he wants to talk about. And the chick serves 27 aces and one wrong double fault, and all she wants to talk about is the double fault. Yeah. So I'm talking about men and women, but I'm actually talking about people and how they are put together. And that's where my skill lies, is spending time with you, understanding you, being in you, and getting you to use some of the mental and thinking tools I have with your skill. You have the skill. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't be talking, whether you're a youngster, but they're all talented. It's a fun space. It's a challenging space, but it's a fun space. Yeah,
important space.
Very important space.
Mike, if you don't mind, and a Christian, especially him being so active and relevant at the moment, just can we tell the story about the poisoning?
Yeah, it's public. It's been the PGA Tour has milked it to death. They actually had something new to talk about when he joined the tour. So, you know, first of all, I mean, Christian is my Klein Neffie. So I guess second cousin in English would be a... the right way to describe it. And we're obviously tremendously proud of what he's done, not just in golf, but where he came from and the thing you're touching on, how his life was affected. And now being selected for the President's Cup is obviously another tick. We had a whole list that I set up for him, which are firsts. The yep. first time you play in a tour event, the first time you make a cut in a Sunshine Tour
My
event.
My first kiss.
Yeah. See, Johan Immelman shared the announcement on his post and something like, Trevor, great selection.
Yeah.
You know, obviously Trevor is his son.
Yeah.
But that was just amazing. And I must be honest, I didn't know he was in contention for that.
Yeah. Christian.
Yeah.
He's no, he was been up there.
Look, you know, when knowing him, you always have a bit of inside information. It's similar. You guys had Eric, and Eric was saying that Trevor was talking to him all the way through, hoping that maybe he'd get up and running and be a consideration, although he knew probably not, but what if? Mm. So he's always, and he was, you know, being a commentator, he's on the range talking to Christian, telling him every time you're in the picture. So he's been in the picture for a long time. It doesn't mean you'll be selected because current form, I think, plays a big role. The fact that he finished the year quite strong probably helped. The fact that he had two more picks because of the guys on LIV probably made it a certainty for Christian rather than a maybe. But the bottom line is he was always in the mix and it was one of his goals. So Christian is a fantastic story, and it all started with him at the age of 2 or 3 drinking the rat poison out of a Coke bottle in the garage, and hospital and pumped his stomach and all of that, and you know, his nervous system was affected, and there was a long time where things were not great. And because of that, it's also well documented that he stutters. And something that has always been a big negative for him, as you'll see on his golf bag now, is the Stuttering Foundation. And he's a big ambassador, and that's a massive deal for him. So, you know, not all things that are bad remain bad for the rest of your life. And he now goes and speaks to, he couldn't speak to 2 people. Now he speaks to hundreds and stands there with no medication. And he stutters. And he doesn't care. He has the confidence that it's okay to stutter, and that means he doesn't stutter as much. So he actually speaks, like when he speaks to me, it's almost sometimes that I ask him, did you forget to stutter? You know, so when he gets nervous, it's a little different. But the point is, things have changed for him. And just this year in the States, being the ambassador, talking in front of crowds, kids look up to him, that all, and all of a sudden everyone stutters. It's amazing that you don't know. You know, I mean, I've known, you know, Rake Nietling for a long, long time, and I went down to see him for a meeting. And we had a great meeting, and we chatted for 30 minutes. And at the end, he says, "I want to ask you something else. Your cousin stuttered," and he starts stuttering. And Rake is a stutterer, and I never knew it.
I also didn't know that.
His mate worked on a program where they can teach kids how to overcome, or at least for the most, overcome it and speak normally. And he wanted to ask me if Christian would be interested to be ambassador to this program and whatever, because we are co-stutterers. And that's the first time I knew Rake stuttered, because he uses these techniques and he's confident. He is a public figure. He speaks. So he's just under control, but I never knew it.
But 2 great examples of nothing should hold you back.
So that nothing should hold you back. So now Christian goes out, and all of a sudden all these people out of all walks of life come to him and say, "But I stutter." And you go, "But I didn't know you stuttered," because it doesn't mean that every guy can't get one word out. There are different levels of it. It's an educational process of understanding stuttering and why they stutter and what triggers it. And in his case, there's all kinds of medical reasons. And then through life, people laughing at you, you know, breaking you down, making you nervous. And as I said, at lunchtime, golf was a big escape for him, because he didn't have to talk to people. He put his earphones in or not, just go stand in the corner of the range far away and just hit balls or chip at the putting green. And when people come, he'd move somewhere else and go work. So to him, it was a place where he could not have to talk, you know, which turned out quite okay when you end up 31 or 32 in the world, because you don't want to talk to people. So that turned out well. But it all started as a scare for the family, and it was a rough time for a while to make sure this kid's going to be fine and medically live a normal life. And now he's 28 odd years old, and he's married, and he's got his US PGA Tour card, and he's about to play the President's Cup, which is not too shabby for a youngster from Delmas. So all turned out quite nicely.
But speaking to you over lunch, to you and Arthur, there were many times in his career, and especially when he was sort of, let's say, the journey up to 18 and 20 years old, where he could have easily just turned the other way because he was accused of all sorts of stuff. You know, there was a karma around the poisoning and like you guys explained to me, but he still mentally pushed through all of that.
He did, and the big thing, and Arthur knows the story well, is that he was on medication for the stuttering, and in that medication there's a beta blocker that obviously slows his heart rate down, keeps him calm so that he doesn't get anxious when he needs to speak. So that was something that he had taken for years, since a very, very young age. And he played in some tournaments in the States with the South African amateur team, and they traveled back, I think it was for the Eisenhower, one of the big European in the UK, and he was about to play there, and they came, and the team manager said, well, you tested positive in the States when we were there. Your samples have come back. And he was absolutely shocked, not knowing what to, you know, and they didn't know why, but he tested positive. So they had to send him home, and he got banned for 2 years by WADA, which is probably right. I mean, and that's when Christian and I really, our paths crossed, and we had to try and help the guy on a legal side, first of all, to get his career back on track as an amateur. And he had to go to the Court of Sports Arbitration and WADA in Switzerland. And because he had no education from, you know, the golfing provinces or the national side, in terms of just in general, you can't use cough medicine. You know, if you do, come talk to us and we'll see what's legal. And because in all of these things are normal daily stuff, but it might just have something in there on the banned list. And that's why top sportsmen now don't just take any doctor's medicine. They go to WADA, and WADA says, if you use an inhaler, which a lot of the athletes do, you have to use this one, because this is the one that absolutely gives you almost no benefit. You can't use any of the others, because all of a sudden everybody has asthma and they're all running faster and they all have asthma. So we understand why it's there. They then finally, because it was a first offense and he had no education and unknowingly used normal life-changing medication, you know, it was reduced to 1 year. And when that ruling was done, there was about 3 months of that year left. So that made it possible for him to see the finish line, and he could rededicate himself to really, because he was practicing. I think you mentioned it at lunch. He was practicing like a demon for 9 months with no tournaments to play. But that's what he does. He doesn't have anything else. It's not that he plays golf and he loves it and he practices. That's what he does. So it was a hard time for him. Probably the worst time of his life, I'd imagine. Luckily, things went, they reduced the ban. Unfortunately, there was no medication that they would approve at all. So he had to completely get off it, which left him with the insecurity of speaking. Because the stuttering would be more prevalent, and he had to really find confidence to speak. And obviously at that time he went to the IGTs and stuff, because a lot of the guys on the kiddies amateur junior circuit, he was a cheater, and they kind of, that's what the parents, and you know how it works. And all of a sudden he was branded as a cheater, and only his one or two real friends stuck to him, and the rest disappeared because he was a cheater. So he would have played more amateur golf, but he then decided, let me go turn pro and play IGTs, and the rest is history. Things worked out quite well. He won a couple of IGTs straight off the bat. Got an invite to the Big Easy and won two tournaments back-to-back, and they were both the bigger versions of him, which got him a lot of points on the order of merit. Did well in the finals, lost in the playoff, and got his card in the cards that were handed out to the top five guys, the order of merit, which we know status is not great, because they drop in behind the 30 guys that get their cards at Q school, so you're going to pretty much pre-qualify for everything. He went to Bloemfontein, and after a terrible first two rounds, he called me in an absolute state, and he was 8 or 9 or 10 behind some English guy. Anyway, we spent 2 hours on the phone one night and just reset the processes, because the result of needing to win Q school messed up everything that he was working on. And we've discussed that earlier. And we spoke for 2 hours about the game plan for the next four rounds, in just executing a process, and whatever the result is the result. And he went out the third round and shot 65, and then shot 66, and then shot 66, and he got himself in the final three ball the last day, barely, but he could see the leader that was still, I think, 2-3 shots ahead of him. And they got to the 18th, and he'll probably shoot me for telling you this little story, but he was one behind on that par 5. And they both hit a decent drive, and Christian was just a yard or two ahead of the guy, and the guy put it in the greenside bunker, but very close to the flag. So it was just going to be a pop out and have a
easy up and down.
It's a up and down. So Christian, in his mind, decided, I need to make eagle. And the best way to make eagle is don't bite off too much, but get it middle green and give yourself a 25-footer. And he did just that. He hit a great iron to the middle of the green. And this guy splashed it out to about a foot and a half, you know. And it's a straight putt. So Christian knew to get in a playoff, I need to make the putt. And he boxed the putt for eagle, which was great. But, you know, this guy then goes up there and he leaves a 1 foot putt short to win to get into a playoff. Now Christian wins Q School. So he calls me straight off. I'm watching on the app, which is the worst way to watch golf in your life.
Sure. Yeah,
I've done that.
A guy makes par, but you go, he should birdie that par 5. Meanwhile, it was a sick up and down and it's a great save. Or,
and it's so delayed as well.
It's so delayed and you don't have it. Anyway, I see all of a sudden he's won it because he's one behind. Now he's won it, finished. The F's come up and I call him and he answers and he's and now he's stuttering so badly and he says he's so nervous. He said, I'm trying to... What are you nervous about? And he says, now I've got to do a Super Sport interview.
I was just going to say this is the thing that scared him the most. I was just going to say to you.
He wins it, and it's like, okay, now I've got to do an interview.
I was just going to say to you, just imagine the fear within himself. I think he must have had it when he won at Leopard Creek, winning Q School. Knowing that you got the chance to win, it's not like, okay, shit, I'm going to win now. He's probably thinking, shit, I've got to say a speech.
Exactly.
At the end of this.
Exactly. Yeah.
That fear inside.
Probably different now, but back then, for sure.
For sure, yeah.
And that must have been unreal to just think of. I mean, that is just
crazy. So the story gets better. So I said, just before you go for your interview, well done. What happened? You know, so he tells me this into the bunker, middle green, box it. He has a 1 foot putt and he leaves it short, you know, he says, and he's obviously stuttering, and he says to me, I think that he was focusing too much on the result and not on the process. And I say,
so he throws it back at you.
That's so rich coming from you after two rounds where you were in a flat spin and you couldn't get your car pointing in the right direction.
I say so, good on him for that.
But the point is, he recognized what happened to that guy. The guy got tight and he left a putt like this in the hole to get into a playoff. So it happens to everyone. In a way, for him, maybe that was a good thing.
Yeah.
I'm sorry for the guy it happened to, but he's like, well, that happens to many people and I'm dealing with something. I'm not sick.
Yeah.
I'm not ill. Every professional guy has to deal with it, and some deal better, like you have a better short game, and some have to work harder at it. But there is a way for every athlete to get reasonably skilled to a professional level. When you're on the tour and you're in the top 100, you're not the best driver, but you've got to be a decent driver of the ball.
Yeah.
If you're Tim Clark or Abraham Anser, your longer irons better be better than the average on tour.
Yeah.
Your short game better be average. But there are many ways to skin a cat, and likewise on the mental side. So some of us are better, some of us choke more often, but we still get across the line. They all get across the line
eventually
because they're professionals. But that you recognize that it's normal to struggle, to be nervous, to be doubtful, to white noise, and I don't know what happened in the last hour. I wish I could rewind the tape and redo it. And why I hit a 9-9 there. I'd never hit a 9-9. I don't know why. At the time, it seemed like a good, stupid decision. So Christian's story is a phenomenal story, and you know, from there things just went well. He spent his first year on the Sunshine Tour, and he became Rookie of the Year the first time. He didn't win. Went off to Q School in Austria. I was on the bag, dragging the bag around Austria somewhere. And immediately he didn't make it through stage one, and I saw that he had the game to do it, and I was watching all the other guys and I could just see that he wasn't ready. Anyway, just prior to that he got his first invite when he got his card, and that was for the SA Open, and he was going to play Monday qualifying, and on the Thursday he calls me and he says, "They BMW, they just called me, this and this, I'm in at Lendauer, I'm playing." It's fantastic. And he ends up finishing second to Brandon Stone and wins himself 1.825 million rand. And we're all in the clubhouse having a good time. And I went outside and his dad came and spoke to me. And he said, oh, that was so close to a two-year exemption. You know, that would really accelerate things. And I said to Conrad, I said, that's the best thing that's ever happened. Because he's not ready to go on the European tour. If he got his card there, he would go out there and probably lose it. And then you get stuck in that whole thing of can I not, am I? So things happen to him, good and bad. But all the bad things seem to be part of organic growth. And it just slotted in at the right time so that he had a natural growth in the person, the confidence, so that when the next step came, he was semi-ready for it. I mean, it's tough every time. So he missed at Q School, came back and played another full season on the Sunshine Tour, won his first event at the Fish River Sun. So that was his first win, not a massive tournament, but it's a win. He got across the line. And then he went to Q School and he got the last card. He sat there I sat with him for 45 minutes on a WhatsApp call while he's describing the 18th as guys come in. If this guy birdies, we move to there. If this guy, and the last three ball had a guy in it who fell apart that day. And if he made birdie, they all fell out. They were tied 25th, but there was 32 of them. So there were seven or eight guys tied on the last card. If he parred, they were seven. He'd be the eighth guy. They're all in. And he says to me, but it's a par five. It's reachable. And I'm talking. He's sitting in my office on WhatsApp trying to see what's going on there. And I said, well, if it was you, would you go for the green? He says, no, I'd lay it up, hit it middle green and two putt. I said, well, that's what that guy's thinking. So he probably, where's the pin? No, front right tucked behind the bunkers. I said, why do you want to hit a 4-iron into that pin to get your card when a par does it? He says, well, I hope so. So anyway, the oak ropes it down the middle. He's like 200 out. And I said, he won't go for it. He won't. So he says, no, oh, he's laying up. He's laying up. I said, fantastic. And now he says, now he's got a lob wedge. He's going to spin this back stiff. I said, well, do you think would you take on that bunker? He says, no, I'll hit it 30 foot. I said, that's what he's going to do. So anyway, he hits it there and he spins it back to about 20 foot. And he's got this left to right. And now all these oaks, it's one putt. And they want to say to the oak, if you two putt it, you're still in. You're still in. You make it, we all out. Anyway, the guy skims the whole, you know, to 1 foot, taps in. And then I hear the seller, and hey, hello. And they all in. And he got his European tour card. And then the next year was hard work. He made it in the third last week to keep it. And as you know, the second time around, you know which courses suit you. His status is better, where I like to play. And I've seen a course for the second time. And all of a sudden, he started winning. He won Leopard Creek. He won Valderrama, which was the big one.
That's a huge one.
Beating John Rahm into second by about five shots, and Sergio was third. So that was massive. Got him a two-year exemption. Then he won Leopard Creek and SA Open. And then off top 50, you get 12 starts in the States. And he tried to get his tour card off just those 12 starts, and he missed by two shots at the end of the year. Came back, same thing this year, but he got high enough that he could go to the web.com's playoffs. Although they start on zero, he's got three events. And if you get yourself into it, there's 50 cards. The top 25 already have cards, but the others are still open for grabs. And he finished 10th the first week, then had a 50th, and then he finished third in the last week and got the fourth or fifth of the 25. So call it the 28th or 29th card. And the rest is history. He's got into the majors off Masters, obviously, is the big thing for him, top 50 every year. And he's got into all the majors now, and he's kind of given up his status in Europe now, and he's just going to play full-time in the States and try and make it his life. And obviously, Liv came across everybody's paths across his as well, and a lot of decisions had to be made. And but anyway, he just wants to play golf, and he loves playing golf, and he loves that. He doesn't want to do anything else.
8 years old, for what he's gone through and what he has seen in this life, he's going to be a tremendous contributor towards inspiring so many people with the journey and decisions that he's taken to see all of that through. So congratulations to him, man. And
absolutely.
I wish him all the best for the President's Cup.
It's nice when all these stories come out, and we always say it's nice when good guys also win.
Yeah.
Good things happen to nice guys and, you know, all of that. But
it wasn't an easy path.
It wasn't an easy path.
A snap of the fingers and I'm there.
Look, what people don't understand is, and this you'll appreciate, is all those things actually prepared him to be a fighter on the golf course. because he had to fight with his whole life. Going to school, they were making fun of him. He didn't have a lot of mates because he can't speak well and, you know, all of that. So all bad stuff then. And then he gets out there and it's actually a good thing because he's a fighter. He doesn't give up. And is this the worst that I'm playing golf for Pete's sake? I can't speak, you know, kind of thing. Yeah, and as you grow on the tour, then you become used to all of that. And the normal golfing challenges come. You lose your feel with the putter and you can't make cuts and things come across. You'll be tested as a professional athlete at all times. But he's had a great journey. And to your point, is it's fantastic that he can tell a story that motivates, inspires, and gives people hope, just not on the not just on the golf course, but in life. And he's telling his story at the moment through that old backing the stuttering organization.
Same as any else, I suppose, to autism and what Nico and them do here as well, and the awareness that he's created for it. And
absolutely,
that brave step, you know, it's even brave to commit to that foundation because, you know, you're sort of exposing yourself.
You do. You put yourself on a pedestal now for those that didn't know, now also know.
Correct. Yeah. And I suppose it's a good time for me to say, I don't have the exact saying, but you should have heard about it, where those guys that were around him mocking him and thinking they were the boys, and it was the best years of their lives.
Yeah.
Time, that 2 years, 3 years at school where
they think
they are the men and they can put this one down and this one is better than this one. It was the best years of their life. And most of those guys I found today are just nowhere. Are absolutely nowhere. The ones that took that nastiness and that meanness. And I suppose, Mike, it is part of growing up and it's part of sort of you know, but I don't like that part of South Africa, and especially South African men, the aggression and stuff that we sometimes see. I won't go into all the details now, but it's something that I, as an Afrikaans guy, try and stand up for quite a bit and take on quite a bit, to say that you think that situation makes you brave or makes you feel like the, and then the real world hits you and nobody cares whether you stutter as long as you can perform on the golf course and as long as you've got some hard work and dedication behind you, people tend to be drawn towards that far more than a cocky attitude. I had a while back, not too long ago, and sorry, that there was a professional player that wanted the sponsorship and he was so cocky in his approach. And I just said to him, I said, you know, I don't know who gave you advice, but that's not what brands are after. We don't care if you walk in here thinking you're the man. And that's not how we want to be represented. And I must be honest, I went quite hard at him. The next day I got a call from his dad. And I was like, oh my word, what did, how far did I push this? It was the opposite. He was so grateful. He says to me, Albert, I'm so grateful that you took the time to not just yes and amen, my son, but you took the time to say to him, hold on, who do you think you are? You know, you're never going to be able to come right with this attitude in life.
And it will mean a lot to him, not just in golf, because golf might not be his whole life, in life. I mean, golf is just, it's just another job. You know, there are many other jobs out there, and people deal with stuff like you guys do on the golf tour, but in their spaces as well, every single day. I mean, Christian is had a hard but blessed life. He's got a wonderful family that supports him and backs him. He as I said, we had this whole list that we pulled up to say the first time you make, you know, your professional debut, that's a tick on the Sunshine Tour. Then you make the cut. Then your first birdie. Literally, when he made his first birdie on the European Tour, I called him and in the evening I said, you need to put it in the book, your first eagle. And double bogey. And anyway, all of it. And eventually on that list, there's President's Cup and there's winning a major, which we don't know if that'll ever happen, but he's going to give it his best. And like I spoke to him straight after the Tour Championships when he missed out on the final 30, and he said, well, making the playoffs was his goal this year. But for next year, it's making the top 30. And making that top 30 is not easy. He might or might not do it, but he has goals. And of course, they become – he had his first hole-in-one on the tour. And, you know, things – go on like that. So it's nice to see him tick these off. President's Cup, of course, is a nice one to tick off. And we'll see what the future holds. But may the nice guys, you know, keep doing well. And he's one of them. So it's always nice following him. And he tells a story, which is also nice.
Yeah.
So,
well, Mike, sport has given you a lot.
Yeah.
But you've also given a lot back to sport. And we thank you for the time that you've given us and talked so, you know, about how much you help other people. But we just want to touch on your business because you're also a big businessman. And Just tell us a little bit about the journey. I said to you earlier that I just bought myself a pair of Rudy glasses, golf glasses, about 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I've enjoyed it. But then you've also said to me that you've brought some other brands to the market. And
yeah, we did for our sins. That's what we did. So when we sold ASG in 2016, which Rudy Project was the first brand in 2006, and for 2 years we only did Rudy, and we did really well with it. We took it from nowhere to the official eyewear of the PGA, and then all the pros knew it, and it was very well received. We did well with it. And when we sold that business, I said, I'm never ever doing eyewear again. You know, that's it. That's good for me. So COVID rolls around and you're sitting at home and you're not allowed on the sidewalk and you start thinking of fun projects. So we said, so I felt like designing a pair of golf glasses, more specifically golf lenses, you know, from my garage, if you like, and take on some of the bigger brands in the game, including Rudy, and just have some fun and see, can that be done? You know, up against these global giants. Anyway, so I called a previous client of mine, Peter Nodier, who is an optometrist and one of the owners of Spectacle Warehouse. So they have labs and they have all these fans. I said, hey, Pete, you know, you sell probably over 20 brands in your store. How about you own one? And he said, that would be so cool. You know, just to not always build other people's brands. They make they have a hell of a business. But just the idea of having your own.
You know, they're a brand in itself.
Yeah.
Stocking brands.
Yeah, yeah. They are a brand in themselves, but the actual eyewear brand, you know. And they said, he said, that would be cool. I said, all right, I want to do this. This is what I want to do. And I've kind of come to you first for several reasons. And what I'm looking for is I want the best golf lens available, and you can test it with all your depth perception, refraction, light, you know, as I said, the best. And it must be compared to all the famous lenses out there. Yeah, and you know, we have the Oakley Prism there. We've got Rudy Project out there. We've got, there are many good ones out there. And I said, at least as good, if not better, at half the price. That was the deal.
Nice challenge.
And he said to me, that's never going to happen. You're crazy. So that whole little fantasy that he was on for 3 minutes just fell right through the floor. Says that's not going to happen.
I'll send you a number of a different guy. Yeah.
So I said to Pete, I said, in that case, bye bye. Call me when you find that lens. You know, so anyway, we're laughing, and it's not going to happen. So anyway, but a couple of months later, he calls me and he says, where are you? So he says, come by, come have a coffee. So I come over there, and he's got two discs. You know, all lenses come in these discs. And he says, check this golf lens. So anyway, I've got these two discs and I'm out there outside looking for anything green I can find in the concrete there, going, holy cow, yeah. What is it? He says, no, this lens is called Amplify. It amplifies. And I'm like, gee, this is unbelievable. But how good is it? I mean, he says, the numbers are off the charts. It's a great lens. I said, let's do this. Anyway, so we start ordering frames online, one from all over the world, things we like.
Samples
from companies. You're just buying for $2 and $5 and 20 cents and anything that looks half decent. And then they arrive here and they're about this big or this. And so we say, this is lacquer. So we pick just four frames or so, say, dye's lacquer. And we send them to our manufacturers in the East and say, copy those, but give us TR96 and these materials. That's the quality one. Anyway, so Pete's on the laser, cut these things. I give one to Sean Norris. I give one to a few other eggs. I said, and they all go. And then for 3 months, they go, this is phenomenal. And I play with it myself. So I'm like, this is the best I've ever had. So anyway, we mess around with this. And I say, Pete, I've done my market research for the pros. It works. So I gave it to guys who play with sunnies, obviously, permanently, so that they can. So go back to him. I say, we're doing this. So then we do the numbers, the costing. And we make R24.12 per pair. That's it. And I said, yes. And Pete goes, no. He said, this is him with the Vertni. I said, that wasn't it. I said, I bet you we could do it at $1,700 retail. Because the other guys are $2,500 to $3,000. I gave him the number. And he says, yeah, my Disney. I said, you can see us come. So anyway, I said, now we have a product. We're not making money, but we have a product.
Over time, we can scale so and then bring Pete our margins says, better.
Why don't we just take it to $2,200 and I already worked out the margin for the shops. I know. I said, it's not happening, Pete. Those are the numbers. In that, we need to find the answer. So anyway, time goes by and Pete calls me and says, I've just thought of something. What if we buy the monomer, the fluid that the lenses are made of? So now if you import it, that's a raw material, so you don't have to import
tariff
duties.
Codes, and it comes with tariff codes. Yeah,
the
actual
baking, setting, curing, and all the labor that you're paying margin on in dollars, you're now going to do in rands.
Yes.
You know, so we have to lay some capital out for the machinery and all of that stuff. Yes. So anyway, we get some machinery. We order this 10,000 rand bottle of Struup that arrives there. We make our first lenses. We teach the oaks. So these oaks, they make these lenses. And then when you put them on like this, feels like you're going over speed bumps. You like get seasick because they're coming out. Yeah. This then the lens is perfect and there's a bubble right in the middle.
But which just stuck there.
But it's all smooth on the back and smooth on the bubbles on the inside. I go, guys, you are way too talented. So anyway, there was a whole, the normal growing pains. And finally the lenses started coming out and quality 90% got to the right side of the dustbin, which was good. So there was a lot of, work and money into it. And finally, we made our own lenses. So the lenses were great. And then we had our frames, obviously, that we wanted. And we laser cut them, beveled them. And then so they are made here.
All of them locally made.
It's a South African product. I'll tell you now where I say it's Spanish. It's imported because it's yonder.
Yeah.
So it's Spanish. Yonder.
Oh, yonder.
I mean, you can hear it's Spanish. So Peter says, how does that work? Do we export it to Barcelona and then bring it back in so that it can be imported? I said, yeah. But anyway, the name is a whole story on its own because we didn't have a name. And in those 9-10 months that we went through all of these pains, Peter one day says to me, I'm tired of talking about Die Brill. Every time, Die Brill. He says, can't we just give it a name? I said, no, man, a brand name will come. He says, no, not a brand name. Just something that we can refer to. So I said, let's call it John Doe and Jane Doe. As in, they don't have a name, but the tag's hanging on the toe in the morgue. You know, we'll figure out its name over time. So he says, that's cool. So we talk about Jane Doe and John Doe, the men and the ladies and whatever. Next February, about 8 months later, Peter calls me one day. He says, holy cow, we need to register the name. We're down to three names. And come by, we need to do this. So I sit there and I look at these three names and I go, Pete, when Schmeck decided to call their brand Schmeck, they didn't know that name was going to be cool, but now Schmeck is cool. So when Reebok says, I'm doing an athletic range, I'm calling it Reebok. I can hear some oak in the farm going, you must kudu genoem
it. Yeah.
They become Nike. When Phil Knight said, is it Nike or Nike or Nike?
Yeah.
Or his mates must have said Nike, Nike. What is his name? He says, don't worry, it's Nike.
Yeah.
And eventually, it's a fantastic name. I said, so Pete, I can't tell you which name will become a great name. But I'll tell you, these three will never become a great name. That I know. They were terrible. I said, they will never become a brand name. So he says, well, we need to decide now. I said, we're going back to John Doe. And he says, we can't do that. People watch CSI Miami. And they think of corpses and morgues.
Yeah.
I said, no, Pete. Yondo. So it's J-O-N-D-O. Yondo. So it's John Doe.
Yeah.
But we can't write John D-O-E. That's bad news. It's Yondo. And it's somewhere, not John Doe. It's Yondo. Spanish. It's from overseas.
Yeah.
So, and basically the story that we tell in our AC Kermans.
M.R. Priest. M.R. Priest.
M.R. Priest. So that's exactly that story where now it's Yondo. And some people call it John Doe, but they don't think of John Doe. They just read John Doe.
It was John Doe.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine.
I honestly thought it
was
John
Doe. Most people call it John Doe because the J in Africa. We went to a Y and that was too Japanese.
Okay.
And I said, I don't want that. That's too Eastern with I where you need to be European connected.
Yes.
And that was just a decision to not go with a Y because that's too Japanese. And anyway, so the story is that the name of this brand right now is Yondo, which refers to John Doe, which is the brand without a name. We don't have a name.
I love it.
So that's the story behind it. And it's homemade. And I signed with the PGA as the official eyewear to the PGA. And that was the contract that I signed in 2012 for Rudy Project.
Yeah, Projects.
We took over and we started with one pro shop. And we're in 56 pro shops at the moment, and we just signed River Club and Leopard Creek and Bryanston next week. So there's another three.
My home club.
We want to get to 75 before the end of the year. So that's mid season because it's now the season. And it's a fun project, and we're watching the kid grow, and we're not sure where this kid's going.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But we're having fun with it. We're exporting to Dubai and Abu Dhabi already. Mauritius. We've just been approached by Australia, Norway and Scotland, Ireland, and then Scott Cullum. I don't know if you know, remember Scott Cullum?
No.
Also in the golf industry. Yeah, he's gone to Scotland.
Okay.
So Scott saw Dave at the British Open. Open, and next thing Scott calls me, he's trying to work out. So we were ready to go international in about 3 years, and they found us. So we're already exporting to 2 countries, and we've got 5 others that we're working with. And there's a guy in the States now who wants to go full platform. He's busy building the online websites. He's already selling 5 brands from Europe. He says he'll make a killing. So anyway, the point is, I did send 10 samples to 10 countries around the world to people I know in the golf industry. And the good news is, this is way back, 18 months ago, and they all said product's phenomenal.
Phenomenal.
Obviously, you need to
find
your
brand. Distribution right. All of
distribution
that.
And your brand must be positioned that people would say, let's give that a try. So we'll see where it goes. It's good fun. It's just, I love building brands, and this is our own one that we started. It didn't exist. So it's not that we're the importers or the distributors. We said, let's do it. We're having fun. It might go nowhere. It might just be what it is. We've already got all the guys that used to be on Rudy Project on the tours now wearing Sean Norris, George Kutsia, all these guys are wearing Yondo, Leanne
Yaku
Pace.
Yaku Fonsail wearing it.
Yaku's called me so many times, he can't get a visa to come to Pretoria. So he's every time. So he's
George.
So he wants them. I talk a lot with Yaku, and every time he has a Sunshine Tour event, he'll say, I just saw Anthony Michael's glasses. But for me, say, hey, ja, ik weet ek moet kom, ja, ik weet ek moet kom. So we've had a lot of fun. We've had 6 wins on Yondo in the last while, which is great. George won at the Zolder last year. He won this year again.
Yeah.
Anthony won.
And just won. Dion Germes has won at Session. Yes. Merrick won at Blue Valley in the doubles. And just won the Island Gate. And I'm forgetting someone, and that'll be very offensive to whoever won it. Oh, Leanne Pace won the European Tour SA Open Investec down in Cape Town. So we've had 6 winners in the last. Sean has won in Japan.
I need to get myself one of those glasses.
Last year. So.
And what's...
You get the glasses, you get a win, but you're back on tour.
Yeah, I was just going to say. And I think what's also so amazing...
And got his first win. He couldn't get across the line forever, so we gave him a pen. There we go. Answer to a winner.
Yeah. Well, Mike, you've just shown again your humbleness. You've taken a brand. You're up against monsters in the industry. That's probably got, you say, you made a few phone calls to a few folks that do a few bit of development. When the big boys do it, it's probably 3,000 engineers.
Yeah,
a
yeah.
budget of, okay, we'll give you $50 million.
We don't know what budget is. We don't have a budget.
Exactly. And here you are 18 months. So I think your humbleness comes through when you say, and I completely understand from a big commercial perspective, obviously economics of scales is when you really get into your success. But I also now sit here and I'm thinking to myself, you're so passionate about everything that you do and incredibly passionate. And that probably drives you to get so much knowledge, because I bet you now, if I ask you about solar panels, then I ask you about sunglasses, then I ask you about IT and copy solutions, then I'm going to ask you about mental coaching, and then I'm going to ask you about the swing. And on all 5 of them or 6 of them, you'll probably sound like the expert in that particular field.
Everything but the swing. I don't go there. That's a dangerous.
I suppose we'll leave that to Arthur.
We'll leave that to
we'll
Arthur.
That to Arthur.
I don't even want to go down
there. Arthur will leave it to John and the rest.
Yeah.
There are a few things in the world. We touched on one of them earlier, and that was women and the mind and then the swing. Those are things that you'll never figure out in one lifetime. But look, I said it at the top of the show. I've been very blessed in the sense that my life has just taken a route. I haven't looked for anything. And wherever my life has taken me is probably because I followed my passions and what I love to do, whether there was money or not. And then somehow through that, a decent living has been made through that. So when you say there's a lot of passion, it's not passion. It's just we all have that when you talk about the stuff you really enjoy doing. Or and it's a cliche. If you do what you love, you never work a day in your life.
But it's true.
I don't see it that way. I work hard. I have bad days. Yeah. I have all of that. Yeah. Everyone has. That's nonsense. It doesn't work that way. But if I sit down at any time and people ask me questions, and I'll get in the car now and drive back to Pretoria and go, I have a good life, and I've told you about the other things, and I've had a few incidents in my life medically and some other interesting stories for another day. Others will be here for another 2 hours. But just in broad, if you look back, I've had a good life. I've had a fun life, and I want to keep – I've never worked for a salary in my life, and I don't – I'll never have a pension because I'll never retire. I'll keep doing something that interests me. And you guys had Dave on the show. I'm doing some stuff with Dave now that we're very excited about, and it's just lekker and fun, and we're going to see where it goes. And that's what we do. It's what you do, yeah. I mean, this is not going to make money. It's not monetary. It's not what you chase, but you love doing this. You have energy for it. And eventually you can monetize it if you want to. I'm not saying you have to. And certainly the sunglasses, we are not making money. We are funding the growth of the company from that, which we haven't put a cent into it, which is phenomenal. But I'm not getting rich out of it. And someday maybe we will. But it's not about that. The journey we're on is fun. We love developing stuff. I love seeing a guy on a golf course walking past with a pair of Yondos and going, that's us right there, you know. And, you know, when my daughter was small, she... when I had Rudy Project, they'd ask her, what does your dad do? And he says, well, he sells sunglasses like those guys at the robots, you know, with a cardboard. So people were like, you know, that's what I do. You know, and we thought Rudy was a cool brand and a quality brand and whatever. So I'm back selling sunglasses again. But we have fun doing it. It's good fun. It's not always easy, but it's the energy comes from enjoying what you do.
I want to make a call to all South Africans. I mean, to be honest, I feel very passionate, and Christian will know this very well, from manufacturing, local manufacturing, creating economic footprint here. And if you understand it, I won't dive into all of that today. But you've inspired us today, Mike, and thank you so much. I mean, Arthur, I can tell you, you know, sitting here, I couldn't stop just listening to every single word that you said. And thank you very much for the role that you play, one, as a father, you know, and as a businessman in South Africa, that you inspire so much around you. And I won't go into it now, but when you said now about I'm also having bad days, you know, they sometimes say to me like, what life? But I say to them, you know, I don't wake up every day going, yay, you know, I'm ready to take this. Sometimes I just want to turn around and just give me 2 more hours, you know, in the bed to just be completely useless. But thank you very much for the role that you play, and to both Arthur and I. And Mike, I know for a fact that you play all of those roles, because the little interaction we had with people around you, they talk to you as a mentor. They talk to you as this inspirational guy. And I don't want to make it a cliche for you, because what you never know is what you trigger and what happens afterwards. And look what you've done with some of the players. And I can assure you now, yes, we can talk about Christian Beseda because he's in a public sphere now, but there's probably so many people right around you that isn't popular, you know, isn't popular on social media or in a particular sport field that gets automatic viewerships. But thank you for the role that you play. And also for coming to the show, such a big name to come on to you know, Arthur's at least a big name in golf. I'm nothing. You know, Mike, I'm nothing in golf.
You probably didn't even know who I was. I'm no one.
Yeah, well, this is the easiest guy to impress. He thinks everyone's a celebrity. I mean, we're absolutely nobody. So, and again, thanks to you guys. I mean, this was a lot of fun, and what you do, just for whoever follows you and listens to you, I think it's great stories of life that come out through people in sport, which is great. But again, you know, everything I do just happened, and if that means that it touches some people, fantastic. Yeah. And what you guys are doing here through whoever sits on this couch, you're touching people in some way. And if it's, you know, every third show that one guy gets something from this, then it's fantastic, because it changes the world in small ways, and we must never forget that. So keep doing what you're doing, and get more interesting people. I'll be driving and listening when I'm doing the 1 hour shift.
Thank you.
So it's good fun, and it was nice meeting and chatting with you guys.
On the next episode of the Human Golf Show,
we were actually in Ibiza. Myself and the kids and the whole family, like, celebrating the rugby life that's not finished, and I'm going to be corporate now. I'm sipping, myself and my wife are sipping on some mojitos, and out of the blue I get a text message from Rassi saying, listen, is your line up? Are you still available? And I'm like, I thought of Vincent Koch taking the mickey out of me, thinking it's Vincent going, of course, I'm ready. I'm the quickest, the most beautiful, the strongest, the fittest.
I haven't stopped training.
Who can the world? But referring to something, some other profession, right? and extremely expensive. So anyway, so phone it off to midnight. Hello, who's speaking? Hello, Scala, it's us. Because it's, oh my goodness.